just get a couple minutes on the ground here and make sure.
I'm going to ask you if you're on this. Okay.
That's
do you want to do it?
That.
Do you like it?
I do.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. Today is November 17th, 2015. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We have a really, really full agenda today. So I would love it if Adam, our committee administrator, could go over some of the ground rules.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, we have a very full agenda today. So in the service of speeding everything up and making sure everybody gets their testimony heard, everybody will be getting 4 minutes to testify. When we're getting to 3 minutes and 30 seconds, you'll see me hold up this piece of paper. When your time is up, this is what you'll see. You don't have to stop immediately, but please wrap it up to make sure that everybody's testimony is heard. Thank you so much, Chair Kinnegan.
Yes, and I hope you're happy with that. I know we told you 3 minutes, and we knew how hard it would be to get your very passionate testimony down to 3 minutes, so we're actually giving you 4. We're going to allow 2 minutes for questions. We have 25 people on the agenda today. I think it's 15 for housing and 10 for child welfare. So I'm very sorry, but we are doing everything we can to get as broad a range of perspectives from around the state as possible from people who sit in different places with regard to affordable housing. I do want to note that our speaker is here. Tina Kotek, so those of you who don't know her, which are probably very few, or those of you who might be listening in and can't see her, I'm delighted that she can stay for the first hour of this. She assigned housing to the Human Services Committee because prior to that it did not have a home, so to speak, and it is because of her both knowledge of the field of housing and her knowledge about how important housing is to everything else that we try to do in the state in terms of economic development, education, health, et cetera. So I'm delighted that she can join in for the first hour. And with that, we are going to start with our first panel is Margaret Van Vliet and Kitty Piercy. This is, I should open up an informational meeting on affordable housing needs in Oregon. Thank you, and I think we'll start with Mayor Kitty Piercy.
Thank you.
And just while you're getting settled, what we've told everyone to do is, in as brief a way as possible, give us a description of the needs that you see from the vantage point that you are, and if you want to venture into what you think we need to do in 2016, short session, 2017 is another opportunity to take a big, bold look, but what should we be doing now, and we absolutely cannot wait. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Representative Kenny Geyer and the members of the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Housing for the opportunity to speak to you today. Nice to see you, too. I've been mayor of Eugene for about 11 years, and I've watched our community struggle through the recession and work towards recovery and prosperity for everyone. Access to affordable housing and human services helped many of our most vulnerable residents to move from homelessness to stability. The City of Eugene has been proud to work in partnership with the legislature, Oregon Housing and Community Services, Lane County, and nonprofit partners to create thousands of housing units and maintain support for critical human services. The city supports these efforts by devoting federal entitlement funds, allocating local general fund dollars, providing system development charge grants, and allowing property tax exemptions, all to meet the growing housing need. The city supports a number of creative solutions, including creating designated places for people living in cars and RVs, rest stops, microhousing, and emergency cold night shelter. While these efforts have yielded more housing and shelter options and are having positive impacts for those lucky enough to access them, it's not nearly enough to meet the needs of those who are homeless or those living in unstable housing. Rather than getting on the path to stability, vulnerable residents end up in our courts, hospitals, parks, and jails, some of the most expensive services you could have happen. But none of these systems are equipped to deal with the root causes of poverty or homelessness and therefore deepen the barriers to achieving stability. Furthermore, these challenges serve as a fundamental barrier to achieving our state's education, health, and economic prosperity goals. Eugene residents are both deeply concerned and deeply frustrated by homelessness and lack of affordable housing and its impacts on the people experiencing, as well as all the other residents of our city. While Eugene is unique in many ways, this is something that's not unique. It's happening all over the country. It's happening all over the state. These trends and issues led me to ask the Eugene City Council to adopt a resolution to, first, work locally to create suitable short-term shelter spaces and more housing first units for our most vulnerable residents. Second, declare the urgency of the housing and homelessness crisis in the state. To be clear, this is a matter of national priority, and as such, we must all understand the issues, how it impacts us all, and what we can do to make a difference. Third, request that the state legislature recognize the crisis and take action by convening a work group composed of state agencies, local governments, and nonprofit service providers to develop proactive ways to rapidly increase access to emergency, transitional, and permanent affordable housing options, and appropriate funding within this session for communities to make a difference now. Conversations with the governor and speaker of the House have shown that we are all dedicated to taking action for Oregonians in this time of our need. Our city will continue to be part of the solution, and we are always ready and willing and able to partner to accomplish our goals. Thank you so much for the time to speak today about the really challenging times we find ourselves in as a city and a state and a nation. And I look forward to working with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mayor Piercy? Okay, we'll leave a couple minutes for later in the hearing.
I do have a slide presentation. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Glad to be here to join this important conversation this afternoon. I'll quickly go through these slides. You've got them, and as well as a report on activities of the agency in OLIS this afternoon. You've seen this vision and mission statement for the agency. I think the piece I would underscore for you today is this idea that we very much see our job as engaging leaders to develop the integrated statewide policy that helps us address poverty and provide opportunity for Oregonians. That in addition to providing stable and affordable housing across the state. You've seen this data. I would say to you, it continues to get worse. And you will hear more about data, so I'm doing a light touch on data here today. But these ideas of people being rent burdened, one in three Oregonians pay more than half of their income towards rent. That is not a sustainable model for a household budget. And there's a large percentage that pay more than 30% as well. Only one in four households in Oregon who are eligible for a federal rent assistance voucher are receiving that voucher. And that our housing authority partners continue to experience very long wait lists for their voucher programs. Rent burden, seen another way, is to look at how many renter households across our state are considered extremely low income, 131,000, and there are only 28,500 available and affordable units to meet those households. So as a way of looking at the gap in our shortage, the shortage of available housing, that's over 100,000. That's a pretty startling way to look at the numbers, and again, as we see trends, they continue to get worse. Likewise, public school children, an increase over the last year in the number of children identified as homeless by our public school systems. The agency that I run, Oregon Housing and Community Services, has been working hard, really going back to our overall redesign that we've been working on for the last 3 years, to really cut across all of our programs and drive towards greater impact and putting more dollars out on the street. So I'm going to briefly show you across the continuum of our programs the kinds of things we've been doing. There's a little bit more detail in OLIS. We do provide a suite of homeless services. We get federal and state money. We've served close to 18,000 households with those services in the last biennium. And by our best estimates, for any $1 million in new money into these funding sources, particularly the emergency housing account, would allow us to help prevent or end homelessness for up to 700 households. Also in the area of housing stabilization, we operate energy assistance payments and weatherization programs. You can see these are very large programs. The biggest one of these is the federal LIHEAP program. 174,000 Oregonians got help paying their heat bills in the last biennium, and we were able to weatherize and upgrade close to 3,600 homes. We're going to continue to drive impact in these areas as well. I want to specifically talk about production in multifamily housing. And you'll see in the chart that our trends are looking really good. We're driving more production. And in particular, I wanted to report to this committee that we have committed these substantial funds that we talked with you about back in March, particularly the document recording fee funds. We have committed those resources, and those resources are going to projects all over the state. I will wind up there and be happy to take any questions.
Okay, questions? Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Margaret, on slide 3 with the percentage of income going toward rent, do we what are the percentages, or do you know, on for mortgages? Like, what percentage of Oregonians are paying more than 50% for their home mortgage?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Stark, I don't know that off the top of my head, but what I would say to you is when you get a mortgage, your income is underwritten, and so there's a more rigorous process to qualify for a mortgage. So in most cases, it's probably right around that 30 to 35%. But if somebody's lost a job or their income status has changed, of course, we know that that can change over time. So I don't know that data. I'd be happy to follow up with you.
Thank you.
So I would just say briefly, because we have an opportunity to bring you back every time.
Yes.
One of the takeaways that I have from both the September meeting and this is that the message came through loud and strong from this committee about the need to get those dollars out the door. And you had an allocation amount earlier this fall that I think was $20 million that went out the door, and another right. That's going out the first week of December. Is that correct?
Right. So we have committed, of the $90 million that we expected to get out the door back in March when we spoke to you, we have committed 80 of that, and we have another offering that will go out in December. So we've made really good progress.
Okay, great. Representative Mueller.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your effort in getting the money deployed into the communities that so deeply need it right now. My main concern is fully understanding what's causing such a crisis all over the state of Oregon with regards to affordable housing. Can you provide any insights to the primary drivers to this problem?
Yeah. Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Bueller, it's a complicated question, and I know this committee has talked about this over the past many months. You know, from where we sit, we certainly see rents and real estate prices generally rising much, much faster than people's incomes. And so that gap in what we consider affordable is the key thing that we pay attention to. And there's lots of factors that go into both of those equations. But we're just seeing this, the very rapidly escalating real estate prices that probably have, a lot to do with a lot of different factors, supply and demand. And the other thing I would say about that is for most of us, our housing needs are met really by the private sector. And we have these tools that the government uses to sort of work around the margins of the housing sector. But mostly it's private sector dynamics that drives, that are influenced by supply and demand. So wish I had a better answer for you.
Okay. There are going to be a lot more people that can take a crack at that. So thank you for the question. Thank you for your testimony.
You.
The next panel is Kurt Krieger, Lynn McConnell, and Val Velfrey, representing different parts of the state, housing authorities, and housing bureaus. And jump right in.
Good afternoon. My name is Kurt Krieger. I'm director of Portland's Housing Bureau on behalf of Commissioner in Charge of Housing, Dan Saltzman. It's my pleasure to be here, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm new to Portland City government, but not new to housing. I've worked in Metro King County, Seattle, as Chief of Housing and Economic Development. Most recently worked for Fairfax County, Virginia in the D.C. market. And I've worked in private development in Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Arizona. I also worked in rural development early in my career, both in Yakima Valley and in Arizona. So an overview of Portland, I draw your attention to the slides. On October 1st this year, we published the State of Housing in Portland, which is a snapshot, an annual year-over-year comparison. We're going to be doing this annually. So this is fresh data of over 257,000 households with roughly over half, 125,000 renter households in Portland. Of those, 66% of the renter households earn less than 80% of the median income, or less than $58,800 for a family of three. And I might add that of those, 70% are rent burdened, using Margaret Van Fleet's point. Portland is currently experiencing increases in rent that are higher year over year than any other metro area in the country. In the month of August, the annual year over year rent increase was 15.4%. We eclipsed Oakland for the first time in 12 months. So we have a state of an emergency, which I will discuss later. With respect to trends, we have seen added growth of 7,000 people, 5,000 households between 2000 and 2013, many of which were in the central city. We consider that really good news. Our production numbers have reached pre-recession levels, with some 1,500 units produced and some 5,100 permitted in 2014 alone. Of that, I might say that our Portland Housing Bureau has a pipeline of 1,650 units in 19 different projects citywide. We are seeing a shift in the tenure of development citywide from ownership to single-family ownership to multifamily. Of that, a low point of 2008 was 41% renters. We're currently about 49% renters, and we're trending up into the mid-50s, we think, in the near future. We have seen real declines in income, some 5.4% in the last 3 years, which has exacerbated our rental housing problem. Income disparities, especially amongst community of color, is pronounced, with 24,000 to 38,000 incomes lower amongst communities of color, households of color, compared with their white household counterparts. And we have an intractable and ongoing homelessness problem, with no change in numbers in the last 3 years, even though we've housed more people with permanent supportive housing. We still have a troubling increase in homelessness amongst African Americans and amongst women, some 48% and 15% respectively. Neighborhoods of choice are increasingly slipping away from us. We used to see housing affordability in North and Northeast Portland, and I will show you in some quick graphics, those communities are no longer affordable. People of color are often living in very south and southeast Portland. We currently have a deficit of some 24,000 housing units citywide, which is my job to help resolve that problem. I show you these graphics because, as you can see, affordability amongst very low-income people doesn't exist. Amongst people of color, it does not exist. And as you see, amongst home ownership, the real opportunities are in the east and southeast of Portland. The emergency action set into place by City Council about a month ago established 90-day notification for renters, and for the duration of the housing emergency, we're waiving zoning codes for new sightings of emergency shelters. We also have the ability to waive certain permits. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, and there are a couple of other slides that go into more detail about our current housing pipeline.
And I do want to let people know that these materials are all on OLIS. So for those who might be listening in, olis.leg.state.or.us. Just check on materials. You'll get all the presentations. Representative Buehler?
Thank you very much for the presentation and the data especially. Would it be possible to provide an exemption to the urban growth boundary expansion process for affordable housing units?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Evans, and Speaker Kotek. I'm sorry, I'm off one. Representative Buehler.
I'm honored, Evans, though.
It wouldn't affect Portland because we're entirely within the urban growth boundary. I can't speak for Clackamas County and Washington County, but it would have no effect within the city of Portland whatsoever. We are looking at other ways to help incentivize affordable housing. At the present time, we are waiving system development charges for accessory dwelling units. That's some $22,000 per unit, and we're receiving one a day, about 350 so far this year. There are some other tax incentives we think would also be worthwhile. The City Council and Board of Multnomah County Commissioners has granted some $3 million in multifamily tax exemptions this year and next year as well.
Melissa. Okay, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I was really, it's not a City of Portland issue directly, but I was really disturbed to see the article that came out around the time property taxes were delivered, that while Portland has said, hey, we want to put out these accessory dwelling units and we want to create more affordable units, Multnomah County came in right on top of you and reassessed those properties and drove up the property tax prices, which doesn't make those units affordable anymore if people are going to have to absorb that. What's the City of Portland doing to work with Multnomah County to address that problem? Because to me, that sort of seems a little bit bait and switch when we're asking people, can you put these units on your property and, you know, and use them? And now suddenly, you know, the property tax bill jumps through the roof and it doesn't seem like they're backing down on that. I'm just curious what your thoughts are, because I think ADUs are an important part of the affordable housing model, whether they're going to be sited with a home, sited on a church property, sited, you know, lots of different ways we could look at how we use those and increase the capacity for them, but not if we're going to jump up people's property taxes at the same time.
Well, we agree, and we're troubled by that policy interpretation by Multnomah County Assessor. We understand that it was a new interpretation established this year. Our 2035 comprehensive plan estimates some 3,000 accessory dwelling units over the next 20 years, so we want to continue to incentivize them. They're good land use and they're good utilization of property. The city is talking with the county in this regard, but I think it's going to be probably up to one or more of the aggrieved property owners to appeal that determination. It's obviously a financial interest of the county to maximize their return as much as possible. They have interpreted that the approval of an ADU is a rezone, which we do not agree with. Mm-hmm. We're not rezoning the property. We're merely allowing a second unit on that property.
Thank you. Quick question, because we can't solve all the problems here. We just want to highlight them all. So, Representative Taylor?
I can wait if you want.
Okay. Thank you.
Lynn?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. I'm Lynn McConnell from Neighbor Impact in Central Oregon. I'm here to talk to you about the housing climate in Central Oregon and how things have changed recently. I'm eager for you to meet Jessica, who's back in the back of the room, who can tell a story that is as amazing as she is. And so you'll hear a little bit of an on-the-ground perspective momentarily. I think it's not an understatement to say that we are facing a crisis in Central Oregon around housing generally and affordable housing in particular. Our vacant rate, as you may know, is around 1%. This means there are two or fewer units available in each of our small towns at any given time. Typically, we hear reports of 20-plus applications for each unit. Each application typically costs at least $40 per adult in the household. So a two-person household, you can imagine how much money is going out the door just to get in line. The average rent of available units is about $1,350. Most of those are freestanding three-plus bedroom homes, which are completely out of reach. Fair market rent, according to HUD in Central Oregon, is about $802. So there's a huge discrepancy between what we're able to pay, even when folks do qualify for assistance, and what is actually going on on the ground. A recent study indicated that in order to live in the U.S., people needed to make about $16 per hour to survive. In Central Oregon, that's about $19 an hour. That was last spring, in order to be able to get into any rental unit around. So the wage question is at the forefront. More than half of renters in Central Oregon are rent burdened, which means that they spend far too significant. And this has repercussions on many other aspects. For instance, our food bank is seeing continued and increased demand despite, you know, the recession narrowing down and hopefully going away in the near future. Our Head Start programs have seen diminishing enrollment because people are unable to find housing, and so they're forced to move elsewhere. I think that perhaps the best way to explain to you the situation that we're seeing on the front lines is to tell you just a couple of stories of calls that we've received recently. Last week, one of my staff members got a call from an 80-year-old woman who's living on Social Security and is unable to make her $700 a month rent. She had half of it, but was desperate for assistance. And we had to tell her, we can't help you. Another call that we received this spring was a family of five who owns a small business and has been completely self-sufficient, has never received benefits of any type until the father was diagnosed with brain cancer. With these small children in the house, they were forced to close their small business. They came to us for assistance, and we said, there's nothing we can do to help you. A woman with domestic violence in her past who has worked in the healthcare industry. She averages over 60 hours a week and has been stable in her job for several years. She transitioned. She has two small children, transitioned to a one bedroom and was sharing with her children to try to save some money. Her rent was increased from $740 to above $1,000 in a matter of months, and she became homeless. This is a middle-class person in the healthcare industry, the type of people who typically would contribute, but because of the dramatic increases we've seen on the ground, she was staying with us in our shelter. There's an endless number of stories. I asked my staff just before coming to this hearing, what can you guys tell me about the people that we can't help? And the emails I got were very lengthy. Our best weapon in this fight is flexible funding like EHA, which helps us fill gaps, help people in a variety of ways, and allowed us, Neighbor Impact, to serve 560 individuals last year.
So EHA is Emergency Housing Assistance.
Thank you. As I said, it's a crisis level in Central Oregon. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today and look forward to seeing what comes next.
Any quick questions for Lynn? Okay, thank you. Val.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and committee members. I am Val Valfrey, Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Washington County, and also the county's Housing Department Director. I represent one of 23 housing authorities across this great state. I also serve as an appointed member to the State Housing Council. My agency offers stable and affordable housing opportunity to nearly 5,000 low-income households, including veterans, seniors, disabled persons, and the homeless. The affordable housing shortfall in Oregon is real and poses an increasing hardship for low-income families everywhere. As rents rise at alarming rates, low-income residents are either being displaced or struggling with severe rent burdens. This lack of affordable housing, coupled with high rental costs and low vacancy rates, mean that even households with rental assistance may not acquire housing. Many housing authorities are seeing higher voucher turnback rates where clients cannot find housing that meets HUD rent limits. In Washington County, we're seeing a voucher turnback rate of over 40%, a multiple over previous years. And recently, we had to return over $220,000 in federal Shelter Plus Care rental assistance for homeless households with disabilities because they were unable to acquire housing even with that rental assistance. In Washington County, we received many calls and messages from low-income households reporting income increases of 20% or more, providing a burden to their limited incomes. These families have no choice but to pay most of their income to rental costs or run the risk of homelessness in a housing market that offers almost no options for low-income families. To better illustrate, one of our citizens recently sent the following inquiry to our county commission that I believe will likely resonate with all of you. Quote, I am 24 years old, married, have a full-time job, own my car, pay my taxes, yet I cannot afford to live in the town I grew up in. Last week I was notified by my apartment complex that I was receiving a 20% hike in my rent, almost 40% over 2 years. They only gave me 40 days notice. How am I supposed to live and grow in a city I've always called home when I can't afford to have a safe and decent home? I plead to the leaders of this community to try and make a change. The rent increases in this city are forcing people to leave or be trapped in a cycle of never being able to afford a home because all of our income is going to rent and not to savings, unquote. In closing, a lack of affordable housing, high rents, and now no-cause evictions are adversely impacting working low-income families and disrupting the very social fiber of our communities. Vulnerable families do not have the resources to patiently wait out this crisis. The moral imperative of that action is needed now. To ensure house stability for households and their children, we need action at the state level to identify additional funding sources to increase the supply of affordable housing, particularly for households earning less than 50% median family income. And we also need action to remove existing pre-exemptions that undermine innovative local options to effectively deal with this housing crisis. I thank you all for this opportunity to testify to you today.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, it's a question, it's an observation. I don't know what else, but, you know, Val's very familiar with my district, House District 30, which is where our major high-tech industries are located, Intel and Genentech, and a lot of the housing there came in after that, so it's like $300,000 up. And so, you know, I guess what I want to get at is my neighboring district, 29, though, is where a lot of the Latinos live. Not in my district, but next door. Housing stock is quite different in that district. I guess, and it kind of gets to Representative Buehler's question of roots of this issue. We all know that we're increasingly getting segregated schools in this state, segregated by culture, color, ethnicity, and so on. And you can imagine then that the housing would also correlate with that kind of segregation. When we talk about Portland, I was at a presentation by a demographic expert a year or so ago, and he was explaining that with the regentrification of the Albina District, Northeast Portland, a lot of the African-American community, the more affluent folks moved to Vancouver, and the low-income ones more to eastern Multnomah County. I'm just raising the point that we're really talking about segregation as well in terms of communities of color with regard to the need in terms of affordable housing. And I just want to make sure that we're aware and cognizant of that kind of thing going on as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any other questions? Okay.
I just have one quick question for Mr. Krieger. I'm trying to understand. I think everybody here is obviously very concerned and want to solve the housing situation here in Oregon. In other states that have faced similar crises, what are the market mechanisms that they use to get out of this situation? Do we fail? Do we not have the incentives for developers? I understand that some of the folks won't be able to pay some of the market rents, but that was an average that was in the slideshow that Ms. Van Fleet showed and what you showed. And so some of the people most are close to that average and would be able to pay some form of a rent. So how have other states worked their way out of this? What are we missing here in Oregon? I was wondering if you knew about that.
Well, there are several. Chair Kenny Geyer.
You get to be king for the day. Tell us what we can do here.
I would observe a couple of things. First, the city of Portland needs to avail itself of all of its existing tools. And there are a couple of existing tools that we've moved forward since my tenure in the last 90 days. One is the amount of tax increment financing that we're putting into housing has gone from 30% to 45%. That's a $67 million increase just approved in the last month. Mind you, tax increment financing can only be used within an existing urban renewal area, which by statute is limited to 15% of the land area of the city. As we look at existing URAs that are mature, we're projecting where new ones ought to be to help support bus rapid transit, for example, in East Portland. So there could be new URAs established in the future, depending on the City Council and the Portland Development Commission. We are maximizing other revenue. I believe that Commissioner Salzman has a particular interest in using the already budgeted short-term rental revenue collected from Airbnb to help provide funding for permanent affordable housing, because we're losing affordable housing units to the short-term rental market. Val Valfrey mentioned the turnback rate of vouchers. In the last week, the Portland City Council has matched Home Forward, the Housing Authority of Portland's effort to conduct a regional economic analysis to come up with a local FMR, and Washington County, Clackamas County, and Clark County and Vancouver are participating in that effort. The HUD methodology for FMRs uses three-year-old data, trended forward. We don't think that, given the velocity of our market, that that is sufficient. So this winter, we will have finished that work, and we will make our case to HUD for a higher fair market rent so that people with vouchers can find a place to use them. And then finally, You've had hearings in the previous session about inclusionary housing, inclusionary zoning. The city of Portland is recalibrating its central city bonus density incentives, which is voluntary inclusionary housing, by giving developers incentives in the form of higher density, 50% increases for affordable housing. That will apply to the central city, but it won't apply outside of the central city. So we do think that inclusionary housing has a role. I might add that I worked for Fairfax County, Virginia previously. For 25 years, they have used inclusionary housing. Countywide, 12% of the housing stock is required to be affordable for every project over 50 units. And in transit-rich locations such as Reston and Tysons, 20% of the housing stock is required to be affordable. The county gives density bonuses in exchange for those obligations. And it has produced over 7,500 units of affordable housing with no subsidy attached. So I think there is a multitude of tools, some of which we need to activate that are currently authorized, and then we need new authorities such as inclusionary housing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So the next panel are going to be representatives of the rental landlords. Can I please have Phil Owen, Gwen Baldwin, and Sean Jillians? Are you all here? And, you know, again, your directive has been, tell us what's happening, to the rents in for the people that you represent. How much are they going up? How often is eviction being used? What is causing the crisis? And what do you think, with your hat on, we should be doing to get out of this? So who would like to start?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Okay. Hi. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Gwen Baldwin, here today representing Multifamily Northwest. Our members have approximately 165,000 units of rental housing all across Oregon, ranging from folks with one or two units to members of over 18,000 units. Today, in many parts of Oregon, rental vacancies are 3% or less, and demand is pushing prices way up. We got to this place in large part because during the Great Recession, virtually no multifamily was developed. And at the same time, demand for rentals increased from displaced homeowners and Oregon's healthy, strong immigration. And the surge of short-term rentals, frankly, didn't help. Supply will catch up and the market will correct, but in the near term, the challenges for many renters are painfully real as they try to find rentals they can afford. We know this. We see this. Multifamily Northwest has ideas to ease the situation in the short term, but first let me flag two concepts that have negative impacts on housing affordability. First, extending the length of time for all end of tenancy notices will harm the safety of our renters. These notices are inaccurately termed no-cause evictions, and they are rarely used. In fact, our online rental forms are used by one-third of the rental units in Oregon. And in the past 12 months, just 4% of the units in Portland and in Bend received an end of tenancy notice. These notices can only be used when a rental agreement is up for renewal and address situations such as when other renters fear retaliation in the case of gang or drug involvement. If this tool is restricted, it will be good renters who leave to find housing, adding to the demand problem. Another concept, lifting the preemption on rent control, will increase costs and unfortunately won't produce the desired effects. San Francisco has both rent control and affordable unit development requirements, and the result has been notoriously high rents and, frankly, few affordable units built through the over 20 years that they've had the zoning requirements. But what is workable? Well, the most effective way to increase supply at all housing levels is to speed up local development and lower costs. Imagine the results if building affordable units got to the top of permitting and approvals came in a matter of weeks, not months. And we all need to do more to publicize what's out there, including vertical housing, multi, and the other tax abatements and exception programs that are out there, and to make sure they're user-friendly. That said, there are a few state policies to consider in the 2016 session. First, provide more short-term state rental assistance to help vulnerable renters with the housing needs, and look at resources. Frankly, consider earmarking the state transit lodging tax paid by short-term rentals, or look at temporary surcharge for the recording fee for 2 to 4 years. We would support those conversations. Expand bonding for affordable housing and speed sales of funds approved in the 2015 session. We shouldn't have to wait for detailed projects or rush the project details before selling bonds and having the money ready to go. Identify any state barriers to local governments speeding permitting or facilitating additional multifamily units being built. Pass a resolution calling on Congress to extend Home Forward's moving to work status for all housing authorities in Oregon. This designation will help low-income Oregonians get into housing faster by giving housing authorities more flexibility with their vouchers. Last, recent media attention has focused on a few instances where significant renter turnover occurred after buildings were sold or renovated using end-of-tenancy notices. As I stated earlier, these notices are rarely used and critical to remain for the well-being of our residents. However, we are willing to look at the dynamics around building sales and renovation and identify workable modifications in the short term. Multifamily Northwest appreciates being here today and looks forward to working with you in 2015 and beyond on the critical issue of housing affordability. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
So one of the things I didn't hear on your list of things we could do that I'd like us to, you know, have a discussion about, it's obviously not going to be today, but some type of capital gains or deferral or abatement for people who are building affordable housing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that one of the things I hear from builders is that it's not necessarily that they, you know, maybe it's a land use issue or maybe it's a systems development problem, but a lot of times it's a capital problem. Mm-hmm. So how do we inject capital without the state picking up the tab directly and say, okay, you know, you're going to go out and take this risk. We're going to help you mitigate the risk. But I have yet to hear that as being a tool, and I'm just curious what industry thinks about the ability to use the capital gains for people who are committed to building affordable housing and so that people can roll their own capital into building the next project. I'm sort of mystified that the capital side of this is not coming into it, because we're asking builders to take a lot of risk to put these units up, and if the market busts and they have high land costs or some other, you know, issue. I mean, we saw that in 2000, 8, 9, 10 as the housing market crashed. Is that a viable tool?
Representative Parrish, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Frankly, when I looked at the list of people who were testifying today, I assumed that that would be handled by people much more knowledgeable and well-versed in the development side. But I'm happy to follow up after the hearing.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Thank you, Chairman Geyer. My name is Phil Owen. I'm a landlord from Portland. I own 65 units of apartments housing over 100 people. I'm also the legislative chairman of the Oregon Rental Alliance of Oregon, a nonprofit association. We have 1,800 members, 81% of which own 10 units or less. Thank you for the opportunity to address the affordable housing needs. While I'm not a policymaker, an innovator, a real estate developer, I can tell you from a landlord's perspective that what will help the housing problem is more supply. That means incentivizing the property owners and developers to produce more units, remembering that if you want more of something, you have to incentivize it. If you want less of something, you put more obstacles in the way. I understand that some of the answers being offered to this affordable housing situation is a moratorium on no-cause terminations. I want to let you know that their no-cause is incorrect wording, because there's never a landlord that wants to have a vacant unit. There is never a landlord that wants to see somebody without a home. There's always a reason to terminate, to end the contract, because that's what it would be, is a non-renewal of the current contract without a cause. This The Oregon law currently normally has a 30-day contract. This allows somebody to be let go. If you extend that to a 90 or a one-year situation, then the neighbors that are living next to the bad actors, the bad tenants, are going to have to put up with that period of time. Changing the notification rules does nothing to increase the number of units available, which doesn't change, so that doesn't change the ratio of people to housing units. But you have the power to help correct this problem, and you're already doing that by your commitment to building more affordable housing and by taking down the barriers for developers. Once the units come into the market, the rents are going to adjust themselves. The answer is not short-term, short-foresighted solutions, but long-term solutions. This is not a tenant-landlord issue. This is a supply and demand issue. I will tell you that I am currently building a 9-unit apartment building. It's taken me over a year to get all the permits together because things keep changing with the city. There's a lot of issues there. But we feel that the supply and demand is the thing that we need to be looking at. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for him? All right. Sean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I've also had the good fortune of representing a variety of commercial developers and residential developers as well throughout my career. I think I was going to focus a little more on the home ownership side, but I can sort of dovetail or shoehorn this into rentals as well. Unfortunately, I think what got us here is there's no single cause, and there's not going to be a single solution that's going to solve it. As much as I'd love to come up here and tell you, yes, this caused all of it, and this is the solution, it's just that's not feasible. There are a variety of factors that cause the situation that we're in, dealing with the incomes of our state in relation to the national average, all the way up to the physical cost of housing and bare dirt underneath it. Likewise, it's going to take a number of solutions to get us out of it. And I think looking at one thing and saying that we've solved the problem, or another thing and saying we've solved the problem, we're not going to get the results that we want, and we're going to feel like we didn't do anything. I think you got to throw as many things as possible out there and sort of move forward. The other thing that always has been sort of an issue for our industry, and I'll speak specifically on the real estate sales side, so much of the conversation is focused on 60% and below of area median income, the true affordable housing under the federal definition. It's a lot broader than that, especially at this point. People at 80%, even 100% of area median income can't afford to purchase, can't afford to rent. And we're really seeing sort of a broadening spectrum of folks who are having housing problems and being able to qualify for rents or mortgages. Representative Stark, you asked previously about a typical mortgage and things like that. Right now, the range with underwriting is probably 25 to 40% of your income can go to housing costs. 40% is probably pretty high. You have to have a pretty good credit score to get through underwriting on that. But if you did and maybe could show that you're going to have future income potential going up, that you could probably qualify at that point. You all sort of have two choices when you look at what we're going to do about this problem. You can offer a bunch of carrots, you can have some sticks, you can have a combination of both. The carrots being incentives, and what we do to sort of incentivize more development of affordable units all the way up to that 100% area median income. The stick would be regulations and telling the private sector this is what you must do. Obviously, we tend to favor market-based incentives more than we do sticks, but I think we're certainly open to conversations that include the entire spectrum of issues and what potential sticks could be included there. That leads me into the topic that everyone dreaded when I walked into the room, which said, oh boy, is this the Land Use Committee? Our land use system has an impact on housing affordability. I don't know how we can argue otherwise, and certain folks will disagree with me, and I know one did out in the hall knowing that I was going to talk about this. But since we've implemented our land use system, our home ownership rate has been below the national average every single year. There was one year we equaled it, but every single other year we've been below. You're artificially constraining supply naturally by the system. And that's getting worse now because our system truly went into effect at the beginning of the 1980s. 1973, we passed Senate Bill 100. It takes a while for DLCD to implement the rules. Cities had to go out and draw the urban growth boundaries. Cities, being wise at that point in time, did what any of us would do. They drew them really big to make sure that they wouldn't have to come back for a while. Well, guess what? Those really big supplies are now being used up, and cities are actually coming in for their first round of UGB expansions. A number of cities are coming in for their first round. I was looking in the back. McMinnville started in 1996, just gave up in the last year because there were so many appeals and it was so hard for them to get through it. Woodburn started in 1997. They're currently in mediation to hopefully expand theirs. Newburgh started in 2005, just gave up. It was too difficult to do it. Representative Bueller, Ben, started in 2005, as you know, spent several million dollars and still hasn't gotten very far. So, wow, I can't believe I used up 4 minutes when I thought I would do it in three. Tourette Parish's point, yes, actually that's something that we have thinking would be a great idea to do some sort of financial incentive at the state level. We put so much on local governments to incentivize development there. The state traditionally just puts their money into sort of traditional affordable housing projects, perhaps some sort of tax credit on a sliding scale for traditional development that says if you have X number of units affordable in it, you get this much tax credit. The more you go up in your affordable housing units, the better. Please let us expand UGBs for affordable housing. I'm way over time. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions as well.
Any quick questions? No? Okay, thank you very much to your panel. Next panel will be tenants and people that represent tenants, Justin Burry, Mari Claire, Kalini Fusitua, and Jesse Bennington, please.
Chair Kittinger, while they're coming up, I just want to echo what Sean just said about UGB. I mean, Metro made the decision this year that they're not going to bring anything new into the UGB. They said they had enough of what they need. I got to say, in my community, a lot size of dirt in West Lynn, $250,000, you're not building anything affordable on a $250,000 lot that has not been developed, has done no systems development charges, nothing affordable is going there. So I really hope that is a conversation in the next go-round of housing is the artificial constraint.
I think all the topics are on the table. For those who have any specific, when they see a cost driver, the more you can give very specific examples, you know, in your case, if the UGB was expanded, was that really going to lower the price of the land to the extent that we could build affordable housing? So, I appreciate Representative Bueller's constant call for what is the driver that is creating the situation where it's hard to build it. So the more specific people can get back to me, because I have delved into the Ben situation, it's the first I've heard of the others. But I think it's not always as simple as it sounds. So I really appreciate specificity. So thank you. Who would like to start this off?
Thank you. Sorry, this is new for me. So,
is this your first time?
Yes,
coming.
This is my first time.
Well, welcome. Start with your name.
Yes, my name is Kalini Fusitua. I'm a case manager for ERCO, Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, and I'm a culture-specific case manager. So I work specifically with Pacific Island community. But I'm here today to share the frustration. They're not only the Pacific Island community, but also other community from immigrant and refugee community in the Portland area. What they have shared with me, their frustration is because now of the increased rent, there's a lot of people doubling up. They're doubling up with families, not because, you know, they want to build family bonding and family value. It's not that. It's for survival, because now families are not able to afford all this affordable housing. This is not affordable for them because, you know, their rent has increased 30-40% just within the last month, 2 months. And with them doubling up, and some family are caused to move away from their neighborhood, from them what for immigrant refugee community, we tend to be surround. We tend to live near our churches, our mosques, our temple. Religion is a big thing for us. So with all this rent increase, it's forcing us to move away from our neighborhood. So when we move away from our neighborhood, then now we lose connection with our ethnic group, because this is where we get resources, community resources, because we tend to help each other. We do networking with among ourselves, because mainstream America do not reach out and give us resources. We have to find it ourselves. So when the rent increase and we're out of there, then now we don't have the resources. And then Portland, the city of Portland did a, over at the Alberta neighborhood, you know, they did all this renovation and so forth. So the Pacific Island community moved out of there. So we moved to the east side. But now everywhere, the rent has increased. Now we have to move. When we moved from northeast to the east side, it wasn't just a moving of furniture and our belonging. It took us 2-3 years just to get used to the new neighborhood, and then get used to the school, get used to, you know, the stores, because now the culture stores that we used to live by, now we have to drive to it. We have to drive to church. We have to drive to temple. And because of the distance, sometimes we miss it. And if we don't get the connection with our ethnic group, it is very important that we have stable housing, because it's expensive, not monetary wise, but it's expensive, and our children is paying the price because our adjustment to the new environment, leaving our children missing school, poor grades, poor attendance. Next thing you know, what happened? Graduation time, our children are not there. We're having probably 20-25% graduating. It's because we don't have stability. And then another thing that... I'm sorry.
No, that's
and
it, you're doing
because
great.
Everybody's talking about new development, new housing development. But, you know, new housing development, we want new housing development that include us. You know, we don't live, we're not looking for a studio. We're not looking for one bedroom. We're averaging about 5.6, 5.7 children, not 2.5, mm-hmm. your typical American. So we need housing that would house us, that has room for us. Mm-hmm. So in consideration for new development, maybe thinking so that we can all move in.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You did a great job your first time. Thank you for bringing the voice of the immigrant community. Any other questions for him? Thank you. Do you want to wrap it up?
Sure.
You want to be the last one? So who would like to go next? Mari? You go? Great.
Okay, my name is Jessica
Brantan. Oh, you might
want
to sit there, yeah.
Or could you just bring the microphone over?
No, I'm
going to. It doesn't have to be right up there.
Yeah, you don't want it too close anyway, because it'll fuzz.
Okay. I'm not real emotional and everything, so basically.
Start with your name.
All right, my name's Jester Bennington. I'm a vet. I was a Marine for 3 years. I got out because my daughter was born with Down syndrome and several medical problems. So I had to be 3 hours away at Chapel Hill, and I was driving from Chapel Hill to Cherry Point, and it was too tiring. In a nutshell, long story short, I was in a very domestic violence marriage. My mom finally figured it out, kind of, because, like, it's a mom thing. And she flew out there, and that was my opportunity. So I packed my kids, and we just, like, packed our bags, and we left. I got here on June 12th.
And do you live in Bend?
I live in Redmond, ma'am.
Where?
In Redmond.
Oh, Redmond, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Life changes. She ended up selling her ranch, and so I had to live with her. Because her ranch had a guest house, so it would have been fine. She has bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. She doesn't believe in pharmaceuticals because she doesn't believe in pharmaceuticals, whatever. She won't take anything. I don't know if anybody's ever met anybody with that. She has very manic. And my daughter has Down syndrome. She's autistic. Mm-hmm. We clashed. I have severe PTSD. I'm really smart, I have no problem getting a job. I got hired at the Kirk County Sheriff's Office. Got hired at Deer Ridge in Madras. And I couldn't accept either one of those because I have PTSD. Mm-hmm. I've looked for jobs, and I'm not also pending. I'm VA pending, and the VA, it's a hurry-up-and-wait game. So, like, it's not like I was just not really looking for a house and kind of living off my mom because that's the last thing I wanted to do. Long story short, because my mom's house was a two-bedroom house, my daughter got out in the middle of the night and was in the road, and so the cops were called. And
would you like somebody else to go first and we come back to you, or do you want to try to continue?
No, I got this. I'm so sorry. That wasn't planned, sorry.
No.
I got an adult charge, and I'm not being conceited. I'm the best damn mom I know. Put yourself in my shoes, do what I do, and then you can come talk to me about being a mom. And I invited the officer in. And, like, at the time, it was, like, the worst thing possibly in the world. I was going through a very nasty divorce. Mm-hmm. I got a restraining order so I could have temporary custody of my kids for a year because they can't file for divorce because I haven't lived here in 10 years, even though I grew up here. This is my humble record. Mm-hmm. Long story short, sorry, CPS got involved. So at the time, like, I thought it was going to be the worst thing ever, but I invited the officer in. I showed them that I was doing the best I could. It was not like it was at, like, noon and I was, like, drinking or partying or something crazy, you know? And CPS called. I had been calling Neighborhood Impact trying to get in. Like, I've called. Bethlehem House is always full. There's nowhere to rent. And so they called Neighborhood Impact. Within a week, I had a house. And now I'm enrolled in school. Mm-hmm. And, like, so, like, everything's working out now. And, like, I guess I was just told to tell you that I'm really grateful for that. But I think it's really cool that I don't have to pay rent for a year because I get to...
You need that base.
For school.
Right. Thank you so much Thank you for sharing your story. No apologies for tears. Thank you. Any questions?
Just want to thank you for your courage.
Yeah.
And thank you for coming here. Thank you for your service. And thank you for bringing your dog.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Okay. Mari?
Yes. Hi.
Introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. Representative Kenny Geyer and the Housing Committee. I'm Maria Lynn Claire. A resident of Oregon and member of the Community Alliance of Tenants, and an advocate for tenants with tenants priced out. I'm here to address the needs of seniors and disabled and low-income tenants affected by the housing crisis. A housing state of emergency was formally declared by Mayor Charlie Hales and the Portland City Council. And the accelerated rent prices are what I'm here to talk about, how this has affected seniors and their displacement. Middle-income tenants are experiencing a strain on their budget. For low-income wage earners, seniors trying to survive on Social Security and tiny pensions, people receiving disability insurance and Section 8 voucher subsidy recipients have already lost the battle with the tidal wave of market-driven rent increases. This population is being economically displaced and forced out of their homes. Elders in Action reports 200 calls last month from seniors facing displacement, and I'm one of them. My rent is increasing by 60% in just under 3 years, pricing me out, with many others, out of market-rate apartments with few housing options available. I have exactly 6 months left on my current lease. Low-income housing wait lists range from 18 months to 5 years or more. So far, what we have received after the emergency crisis called by our mayor is a 90-day notification ordinance for rent increases above 5%. But for us, people at the very low income level, this has very little impact on us. I suppose it would help renters of a higher rent class, but for us, it's pretty much meaningless. I asked, you know, if this building suddenly filled up with water, flood water, all of us would most likely be trying to immediately run to safety and get help. People were struggling and about to drown, we would do everything possible we could to save them. And then we'd immediately find a way to stop the source of the intruding waters. In the case with pre-homeless, working poor heads of households with children, fixed-income seniors, and people with disabilities who are struggling and about to become casualties of this life-threatening rent flood, what they're asking for is immediate emergency Red Cross-type response. Seniors are so frightened. Tenants priced out, they get called. They call us, and they're up nights. They don't know what to do. There's no help in sight. Elders in Action told me that they don't know what to tell them. So what we're requesting are emergency resources. Some stay-in-place funding could really help. Keeping vulnerable tenants in their homes versus shifting them all around to shelters where they have to leave at 7 a.m. and returning in the evenings. Seniors, the medically needy, and those struggling with intellectual and mental deficits really aren't equipped to successfully navigate and manage a transient-type lifestyle. People are so frightened about living on the streets because they know that they really can't manage the dangers, and they risk death, actually. They're asking for relocation funding, covering deposits, moving expenses, and transportation. With people's budgets, there's nothing left at the end of the month because it mostly all goes to rent. I pay more than 50% of my money to rent, and so I have to now consider how I'm going to save to move. People are asking for moving expenses and things related, funding for storage of belongings, where they're going to put their furnishings. Many end up losing all their possessions because they don't have any funds left for relocation costs and storage of their property. Two women tenants at a East County complex, after receiving a 90-day no-cause eviction, commented, "We're just going to have to walk away and leave all our stuff." People were asking for funding for pet shelters. They have pets. They feel like these are part of our family. They're important to us. We've already lost everything, and now we're going to lose our pets, too. What we want to do is to, they're asking for some sort of rein-in on the rent increases. It's happening too fast. I just moved, and I've only been at my place less than 3 years, and now I got to turn around and you know, come up with moving costs all over again. We just can't afford it. We need to allow time to get things figured out, putting resources in place, affordable housing built, emergency infrastructures established, with social systems having emergency readiness capacity to serve the needs of people whose lives are being torn apart by market-driven displacement. And three is increasing housing options and funding, and it's been talked about here, and so we certainly need that. But the problem is they can't build it fast enough for people that are about, whose lives are about to go over a cliff. So what we're really asking here is for something really stepped up where we move into a responsible, high-paced kind of mode to provide some sort of interim stability, something that all Oregon tenants that are facing this can have some security and assurance that something will be done for them. If we neglect our moral responsibility to put some type of rein on this problem, whereby rents are rising weekly, we will never be able to build our way out of the crisis. People need stable housing. Without it, we ruin people's lives, destabilizing our communities.
If you could just wrap up.
Okay, thank you. A 63-year-old senior tenant asked, is Portland planning on being senior-friendly or only for the wealthy? So I think it's our moral imperative that we provide balanced housing legislation that serves the housing needs of all citizens at all income levels, not benefiting a few at the expense of the many. And I thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions? No, we'll go on to Justin.
Hi, my name, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Burry, Executive Director of the Community Alliance of Tenants, Oregon's only statewide grassroots tenant-led renters' rights organization. We have over 1,000 tenant members, predominantly low-wage workers, families with children, people living with disabilities, seniors, and people of color. And in Oregon, tenants face a variety of challenges in the form of increasing rents, discrimination, unsafe living conditions, and the fear or threat of retaliation or eviction. We are seeing the highest rates of rent increases and no-cause evictions in our history at CAT. This means that tenants are being priced out and pushed out of their homes and communities. Many are becoming homeless. Children are having to change schools multiple times in 1 year. Tenants are losing their jobs because they have to move so quickly and unexpectedly. And the displacement is having a dramatic effect on people's health and family well-being. These no-cause evictions and dramatically raising rents are forcing responsible and reliable tenants out of their homes into one of the worst rental markets in history, which has a considerable impact on the health and stability of not only the individual tenants, but the community as a whole. This rental market crisis has created an environment that has put more strain on the relationship between a landlord and a tenant, which we believe should be mutually beneficial and respectful. It's difficult for a tenant to feel safe and stable and to engage their landlord in a healthy and meaningful way about their housing issues when an eviction notice or a rent increases might show up on their doorstep the very next month. Furthermore, tenants have barriers to sharing their stories, speaking publicly, and engaging in the decisions that affect their lives. The environment of fear, instability, and threats of retaliation is a harsh reality for many tenants and is a significant barrier for tenants to advocate for the solutions that we need. Tenants have not had the opportunity to play a role in the decisions that affect their lives and whatever conditions have led to this crisis, but the tenants themselves are the most affected by the consequences of these decisions and market conditions. Tenants are paying the price of this housing crisis with their health, losing their housing, pulling their children out of school, and losing their access to the healthy and vibrant and safe neighborhoods that we are creating with transportation options, their friends and family and community, and viable economic opportunities. We hear about supply and demand and how and why the housing market is in crisis, whether it's Oregon land use system, the cost of development, zoning codes, or the fact that so many people are moving to this great state. We can disagree with which policies or interest groups or factors have most contributed to this crisis, but what is indisputable is the fact that tenants are paying the biggest price and bearing the biggest burden. Additionally, we as a community are paying the price with increased homelessness and the associated strain on public services, increased health care needs and costs, and the impacts on our education system when students are homeless or having to switch schools so many times in 1 year, and the concentration of poverty and the overcrowding of certain school districts. No-cause evictions, sometimes of entire apartment buildings, and historically low vacancy rates, coupled with rents that are rising too quickly, are forcing tenants out of their homes with no other housing opportunities in their communities. Speculators and out-of-state investors are buying up apartment buildings to empty them and to raise the rents, which has dire consequences on people's health, economic stability, and their children's educational opportunities. When landlords and developers evict for no cause, only to flip the units to rent to higher income tenants, that is also not adding to the supply of housing stock. The flipping of single rental units or entire apartment buildings worsens the housing crisis and reduces the supply of affordable housing in the private market. We hear from tenants who are forced out of Oregon entirely because they can no longer afford to live here. Incomes have barely budged since the recession, and low-wage working families are taking on multiple full-time jobs or doubling up with friends and family to try to keep up with the rent, because in many cases the rent has doubled over the last 3 to 5 years. To address this emergency, we need bold, immediate action by the Oregon legislature. Our renter state of emergency declaration includes two specific immediate temporary measures that this legislator can and should implement in the 2016 session. We ask for a moratorium on no-cause evictions for at least 1 year so that tenants can stay stable in their homes as we work to identify and implement long-term solutions for 2017. Tenants also need a 1 year notice period for rent increases over 5%. 5% is the threshold of what is considered kind of average or reasonable, to give these tenants more time and adjust their budget or to look for other housing. The current 30-day notice period is simply not enough in today's housing market, and dramatic rent spikes of 50, 100, or even 200% are commonplace. We also need to lift the ban on inclusionary zoning, provide for more revenue for affordable housing opportunities, such as what Marie was describing here, and we also need to raise the minimum wage for Oregon working families, because they are having trouble keeping up as rents are, wages are stagnant, but rents are skyrocketing. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Justin? Representative Buehler.
Thank you very much. It's obviously a big problem. Would you say Oregon has one of the worst affordable housing problems in the nation?
So I know that Oregon has one of the highest rates of in-migration in the nation, which is contributing to the housing crisis. I can't speak for the state as a whole, but I know that in Portland, for instance, the rate of rent increases and the rate of displacement is at the highest in the nation.
Is there a follow-up question?
Yes.
Can you tell me what our minimum wage is on a national scale?
Well, the federal minimum wage is around $7.
Compared to other states, how's it rank?
I wouldn't be able to say in terms of what number we're at in terms of which states, but I do know that the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation and is definitely not keeping up with rent increases.
I think it's the second highest minimum wage in the country. Mm-hmm. We have the worst, or one of the worst, affordable housing crisis. So I think the correlation, there's more to this problem than just the minimum wage.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, I'd say there's definitely a gap, but it's certainly, as everyone here has said, mm-hmm. there are certainly many different pieces to what's contributing to, on one hand, you have wages not keeping up, and on the other hand, you have a lack of supply, which is partly what increases the cost of housing, and there are a lot of things that contribute to that. And so we're trying to close it. So thank you so much. Yes. You say your name again for the record.
Jessica Biddington.
Yep.
Sorry, I just...
Just 1 minute, though, because we want to...
It'll be less than that. Yep. I just want to say a lot of it. I think a lot of it, the problem, too, is that... I'm not good at speaking with the people like this. So I'm going to put this the best I can, but, like...
And great.
People just need to be a little bit more educated in what opportunities are out there and what they can do. Maybe they should learn a little bit more about, what's out there first.
Thank you. Thank you to this panel for helping educate us about your situations, and thank you so much. Okay, next panel are, we now have builders, so we're looking at the supply side here. Martha McLennan, John Chandler, John Russell, we are going to be calling by phone. So we're trying to hit all angles here. And this is a focus on the supply side. What is holding us up on the supply side? What are some of your suggestions? You can give quick reference to the long term, but special focus on short term, 2016 session. Who would like to start?
Good afternoon. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the executive director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit provider of affordable housing, working statewide. testimony that you've heard today really goes to a lot of the different kinds of problems that are contributing to the lack of affordable housing. I think I would characterize it as a little bit of a perfect storm, where the in-migration and the growth in population kept a pace during the recession when building stopped. The building that's coming now after that kind of pent-up demand is coming at the peak of the market, and the rest of the market is escalating its cost structure in alignment with that new peak that was established. If we hadn't had a recession, if we hadn't had a crisis in the capital markets that kept us from building for 5 or 6 or 7 years, I think we would be better, in a better condition. So I think that's one of the big contributors. In terms of looking forward and what we can do, both short-term and long-term, I guess the thing that I would start with is to say that we have the development capacity and the expertise, we need the resources to do the development. So the nonprofit, the for-profit, the housing authorities that work in the affordable housing business have land, have properties ready to go, have the capacity to accelerate their development pipelines. Right now, the financing at Oregon Housing and Community Services in their large NOFA, their federal low-income housing tax credit NOFA, is typically oversubscribed by 3-to-1. The small properties NOFA that they'll be issuing announcements about in the next couple of weeks is oversubscribed 4-to-1. So those are projects waiting in the queue to be financed. We're ready to take that forward. The committee and the testimony today has talked a little bit about some of the things that could help to do that, accelerating the sale of the bonds and the LIFT program. I've heard about property tax exemptions and the possibility of expanding those. The request in the last legislative session and consistently in legislative sessions for lottery-backed bonds for preservation can help that. There's a variety of kind of financing pieces that can be put together that can help address the problem. So with that, we are ready and prepared to build more to meet the needs of the community. I guess one thing I would say as a strategy that we have not explored very much of is this, that most of the affordable housing in our communities is what I would call naturally occurring affordable housing. It just happens to be affordable because it was financed at a certain point in time, it's in a neighborhood, or it has a physical conditions that mean that it has had an historically affordable rent. Acquiring those naturally occurring affordable properties and making a long-term affordability commitment to them is another strategy that we really ought to address. It can add to our affordable housing stock. It doesn't add to our overall stock, but it adds to the stock that will be available for lower-income families for decades to come.
So I have a question about that. Are you talking about the idea of CDCs buying up properties so that they can manage them for affordability for long term? Are you talking
yes.
about land trusts?
Really more the typical affordable housing developers. That could be land trusts, but it could also be the CDCs, the housing authorities, and the for-profit developers who've worked in the affordable housing industry.
So to buy it up and manage it for the long term.
Right. So if I could buy a property for $60,000 a unit, put $40,000 a unit into rehabbing that unit, I'm going to have some financing costs, some reserves, some other expenses, but maybe I can get that affordable housing unit secured for a significant period of time for $125,000 a unit instead of new construction, which would be more expensive.
Okay. I have one other question for you.
Go ahead.
So you talk mostly about the need for resources, for capital to be able to do some of this, and I had also heard that perhaps you, among others, have said that the design review process can also be really long and onerous. That gets a little bit at one of the land use issues. Is there anything you would like to say about that that we should be aware of?
The predictability of zoning codes, I think, is critically important. If I can go into a site and say, I know exactly what the setbacks are going to be, what the pop-in and pop-out requirements, what the roof angles are going to be, if I can get through without going through a separate design review process, that's going to enhance the predictability and the timeliness of development.
So having cities have their
yes.
codes and their processes more efficient.
Yeah,
would be
more predictable.
More predictable. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, John Chandler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I am delighted to have this conversation. I've been working in this field for quite a while, and I think that part of the problem we're facing is the direct and proximate outgrowth of a lack of attention to this issue for many, many years. I congratulate you for doing this. On the supply side, one fact I want to bring to your attention is that we should be doing statewide, according to the State Economist's Office, about 25,000 housing units a year. Our normal is about 22, 23,000. We have a big backlog from the recession where nothing happened. We should be doing 25,000 a year for the foreseeable future, and we will be doing 15,000 statewide if we are lucky. Given the level of demand that we're experiencing, you take off almost half the supply, you are going to get price increases. Whatever it is you do this session, next session, future sessions, don't make that worse, please. We need to expand the supply of housing, not reduce it. To some ideas for consideration, you have to talk about money. This is obviously a multifaceted issue. Money for subsidizing, buying rents down, buying land down, helping pay for people to get into homes and stay there. I'll defer to Director Van Vliet and others as to the amount. I will simply point out that this has not gotten much attention legislatively historically. I'm not mad about it. I just simply observe. I'm old enough and been around this process long enough to remember when the legislature stayed into August arguing about the school budgets. I don't think the Ways and Means Committee has ever stayed 5 minutes after talking about the housing budget. A safe, secure home community is every bit as important for schools' education as school funding, not to diminish school funding. That has not got the attention it needs, and we need to figure out a way to put more money into this system if we're going to actually get on top of it. You have to talk about land use. And I understand this is a theological issue, and people break out in hives every time it comes up. The land use system has costs. It has benefits, absolutely. And we don't have time today to go into them. The benefits, however, tend to be societal. The costs tend to be individualized. One way of thinking about putting more money into the housing bucket would be to think about a way of equalizing that. We all benefit from farmland preservation. We all benefit from clean air and all of that. The cost of doing so is impacted on certain communities and certain individuals within those communities much more greatly than it is on the general public. We have constrained the supply of land. That causes prices to go up. I don't know how much. So don't ask me that. But you can't constrain supply and increase demand and have prices stay reasonable. We have elevated farmland preservation, natural resource preservation, over all other factors. I'm not saying that's a bad decision. It has a cost to it. We have also made citizen involvement a hallmark of our land use system. Citizen involvement is great in the abstract. In neighborhood-by-neighborhood NIMBYism, it has very definite costs associated with it. Some things we could talk about, I think, are simply putting a provision of affordable housing on the same policy level of preference as natural resource land preservation. Just to talk about it in the same tone. We could talk about reducing or limiting appeals for affordable housing projects that are going through the system. We did some work on that last session. There's more that could be done. We could put teeth into the clear and objective standard requirements, and that's kind of land use insider stuff. But theoretically, cities have a preemptive path for approval of projects. Make it so. Make them do it. I mean, that if you know what the rules are going in and there's limited access for people to appeal and derail it, you're going to get more housing built more quickly at a more affordable price. Adding affordable housing as criteria for UGB expansion has been discussed and discarded. I think it's a good idea, at least to talk about it. On the financing side, we need to figure out ways to get more money into the private sector. Part of the recession's outgrowth was the banks getting skittish, and they've stayed skittish a lot longer than we thought they would have. Most of my guys are still doing projects with private money, not bank money. That's more expensive. Local governments have to be discussed, and I think we need to give them more tools. Obviously, I have some viewpoints about what tools those ought to be, but simply developing a program to offset the property taxes they're not getting when low-income housing is built. They live and die on property tax revenue, that gives them an incentive to get more money built. And I think giving them some political cover at the legislative level to make decisions that may not be popular with their neighborhoods and their citizenry is going to be important. We have been and will continue to be. Oh, one last thing. I know I'm over time. It's infrastructure. And we've heard about this. I know of places where the SDCs and other fees are approaching $50,000. And those are legitimate numbers. They're paying for the right stuff. Run the math correctly. You simply can't do affordable housing when that's that level of infrastructure. We need to figure out smarter ways to pay for that than house by house. We are ready to work on this in 16 and 17. This is a critically important issue, not just for my builders as in their profession, but most Oregon builders are small businessmen. They live in the communities they work in. Their kids go in those schools. They understand the need, and we want to be able to part of the solution. Thank you. Glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Taylor.
Yes, can we, thank you, Chair Kennedy. Can we ask Mr. Krieger, am I allowed to do that, to have him come up so that I can ask a question of him with these folks
sure.
here?
Sure. Would you like to do that before John Russell?
Mr. Krieger, because
Mr. Krieger,
is that okay? Thank you so much. I wasn't sure if that was
that's for, fine. Okay. And if you could just introduce yourself for the record again.
This is a Portland-specific question, so I don't know if this is going on in other parts of the state, but I represent House District 41, and that is parts of Southeast Portland and Milwaukee and Oak Grove. And when I was running for office, people say, oh, what are people saying on the doorstep? And what was shocking to me was, especially on the Portland side, somewhat on the Clackamas side, and now that Milwaukee's being gentrified rapidly, and I'm sure all of you are aware of that, and I know Margaret's office is in Milwaukee, the people were talking about how upset they were that a two-bedroom bungalow, kind of what you think of a traditional Portland house, starter house, what was called, at least when I was first married, that my husband and I purchased, they're being torn down, and humongous houses, many of them are quite large houses, are being put on the same spot. These are not multifamily units, and I'm not necessarily advocating that they be multifamily units, but it's going to have the same number of people living in them, a family of usually, you know, 3-4 people living in what are 3,000 square foot houses instead of being the 1,200 square foot house, which obviously when the small house is torn down, the developer has made an investment to tear the house down and then build a larger house, but the density hasn't changed. However, the argument that I've been told is that this is all in the name of density, that we want to get more families, you know, in the Portland metropolitan area. So it's a little bit confusing to me of how we are, the city of Portland at least, and I don't know if this is happening in other parts of the state, is how are we incentivizing developers to, you know, it seems like the incentive there is to tear down a small house and build a big house. And the incentive is not to find a place where they can build a multifamily unit. And I was wondering if anyone could, and this could all just be anecdotal too, but I was just wondering if someone could comment on this.
I'll tell you what I know. Kirk Krieger.
Kirk, thank you.
Portland Housing Bureau,
right.
Chair Kennedy-Geyer and Representative Taylor. Mm-hmm. The draft 2035 comprehensive plan for the city of Portland has been prepared, and the city council has held study sessions, and I was part of the housing element study session. The draft plan takes metro numbers and it operationalizes them at the zoning level. So we would add 123,000 new housing units for the city of Portland in 20 years. Of those, 3,000 would be accessory dwelling units and 10,000 would be permanently affordable, or 8% of the total. The strategy is to hold harmless single-family neighborhoods. We're not planning on changing single-family zoning, and 60% of the city of Portland is currently zoned single-family. In recognition that the central city is an expensive place to do business and an expensive place to put affordable housing, although we have affordable housing there, most of the affordable housing would be in the transit corridors of Barber Boulevard, Powell, Division Boulevard, and Foster Road in your general vicinity, because those are the high-capacity transit corridors for which Metro and TriMet are planning improvements. In the north-south corridors, 82nd and 122nd would likely be focal points. So we're taking commercial zone property and making it mixed use in those transit corridors to get to our 123,000 number. As you may know, Mayor Hales did propose a demolition tax on single-family demolitions. It was a $25,000 per unit tax on the demolition of the unit with a premium for the number of years, i.e. the older the house, the more the money. That did not receive 3 votes on the city council and has been withdrawn. The mayor's office is reconfiguring that. And I do believe that the home builders have raised the issue of how do you expect to achieve your density goals if you're penalizing replacement housing in certain neighborhoods. That's a legitimate issue. We think that density goes hand in hand with affordability. You don't get affordability without density. I can just assure you that. But whether or not there is a city council majority that will support a demolition tax is still an open question.
I'm sorry, I just need to clarify. How does this solve the question they had was, you have a two-bedroom bungalow house. you tear it down, build a huge house, which obviously costs sometimes three times as much money as the original house. Therefore, we are, by definition, pricing people out throughout all of Portland. It's been going on for, what, 10 years, 15 years now. So it's not actually increasing density under those circumstances. And now we're experiencing the ripple effect of, instead of it being a $200,000 house at one time, now it's a $600,000 house. Mm-hmm. So why is the city, and I don't know if this is happening in other cities, but since Portland's the major metropolitan area, why are we doing that? That isn't increasing density in those examples.
Seattle is going through the same thing.
Why are we doing that?
Right. What I can say is that there, in the Mayor Hale's proposal, there was a forbearance of that fee if there were more units added. There was not necessarily a tie to affordability, although we are providing at present a system development charge waiver for ADUs, which is on average $22,000 a unit. we've discussed with Representative Kenny Geyer a very focused property tax local option, which would allow a little bit more flexibility in how we award tax exemption for affordable units. At present, we've budgeted $3 million, and we will allocate that by the first week of December, and we will have another $3 million January 1. Those are developers that are agreeing to keep units affordable for 10 years. So matching those together is in our interest, and, you know, our bureau is overseen by Commissioner Saltzman, who also oversees the Bureau of Development Services, which actually processes the permits. So we're all in the same wing of City Hall, if you will. We think we can get that right in the near future.
And so just the piece I want to add to this, so we don't get too Portland-centric, is what's really critical. And when we talked earlier this week, or last week, I guess it was, what can the state do to either incentivize more affordable housing or disincentivize
taking away
going
affordable
in the opposite
housing
direction?
You're actually
right.
Removing affordable
right.
housing
right.
for no purpose other than someone's profit.
So personally, I liked the idea of waiving the demolition fee if you were going to increase density, but keeping it there to disincentivize just creating bigger, less affordable housing for the same number of people. But those are tools that you currently have and you can debate. What I really want to get out of this conversation is, what, as you run up against these with your different hats on, you run up against situations all the time that either hamper your ability to create more housing or help it. And that's what we need to know. We need very specific ideas, and we have had a lot of them here, and I want to continue inviting those here in the next 2 months before we actually drop a bill that gets at what is it that the state can do to help. Are we, you know, in terms of the property tax, in terms of anything else? Right now we don't have anything to do with demolition tax. So you have the ability to do it if you want. So that's not something where we're going to probably play. Mm-hmm. Something for Portland to figure out. But there are others.
I think taking away people's private property rights is not a good way to incentivize more building activity in Portland or anywhere else. So I'd caution that approach.
Madam Chair, John Chandler again, and there are landmines. I understand the question you're asking, but there's landmines there, and I would be remiss, and I realize Mr. Krieger's only been on the job about 3 months, that I just want to put on the record, I'm not sure they have the right to impose a demolition tax. We are looking forward to further discussions on that topic with our friends of the City of Portland.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That sounds great. One quick question, and we're going to see if we can get John on the phone.
Martha, this is literally just like a two-word answer. If all the recommendations that you had mentioned a minute ago, or I guess 20 minutes ago now, if we are able to do that, realistically, if this is this crisis exists because of the recession and we're behind what would be normal and we just kind of mm-hmm. need to get caught back up to go into a norm again, timeline, if we did all of what you said, is it a 2-year fix, a 10-year fix, a 20-year fix? What's your best estimate?
It's going to be longer than two. Maybe it's 10. We are behind the numbers of affordable units that we need. Some part of those are going to come from the marketplace. At some point, the market will get to a point of saturation, and you'll see that the rent increases will stop. How long will that take? And then how much building can we do in that same window of time? Those are kind of questions. Is it 10? I don't know. It's more than two.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, was there another question down here? Representative Hayden?
Yeah, well, sorry. Kind of. Question, comment. I come from a rural part of Oregon, and could somebody help me with simple math? If you charge $25,000 or $50,000 per unit for the development, how does that equate to affordable housing?
You mean the system development charge? The system development charge is the cost of paying for the capacity of the sewage treatment system. So there are certain infrastructure fixed costs which new development is expected to participate in. And each utility district and each local government have to come up with their own capital improvement schedule and affix an SDC. In our single family neighborhoods, it's in the about $22,000. So that is to pay for the capacity of the sewage treatment system. Many localities, if you're doing a replacement unit with another replacement unit, just modernizing the unit, it may be waived. And in our case, we're waiving it for accessory dwelling units because we think it's good land utilization, and we're not actually requiring those units to be affordable, and many are going to the short-term rental market as Airbnbs. Looking forward to next year, the City Council, I believe, has a commitment to end the SDC waivers July 1. I've proposed to apply an extension for affordable units if they agree to keep the units affordable for 10 years. We cannot give, I might add, a property tax exemption for those units because both the ADU and the principal home has to be owner-occupied, and they rarely are. So that's what the purpose of an SDC waiver
is. I understand the purpose of it,
yeah.
But I don't see how that or adding a demolition tax of another $25,000 or ideas that maybe aren't in place yet, I don't see how that translates to building more affordable housing. I mean, you're talking about building, sewage systems or systems for the city, but how does that help our Pacific Islanders get into a house?
Kirk Krieger again for the Portland Housing Bureau. Representative Hayden and Representative Kenny Geyer. The $25,000 fee proposed by Mayor Hale's office would have allocated the funds to a housing investment fund, which is a locally administered housing trust fund. It's allocated annually to developers of affordable housing. So it would have been an offset to the cost, presuming that the unit itself was not affordable, but it would generate funding for an affordable unit. Of course, $25,000 doesn't buy you a complete unit. It only contributes to that cost. That's the nexus.
Okay.
Very quickly, Madam Chair,
Representative
Hayden, in response to your question, it is a challenge. And by it is a challenge, I mean it's impossible. The problem that I wanted, this is the reason I asked for the time, Madam Chair, is not just to slap SDCs around. We've done, local governments are charging those fees because we'd have sued them if they weren't right. Are those numbers are accurate numbers of what it costs to do water, sewer, et cetera? The problem we've got is we have a property tax system that took the authority away, the ability away for local governments to use the property tax base to pay for infrastructure improvements at the local level. And if you want to go back historically far enough, it goes back to the Nixon administration when federal revenue sharing was turned off. It used to be that we all paid for roads someplace else in the state. That state paid for schools someplace else in the state. We don't do that anymore. We've gone to a user fee basis. And I'm not quarreling with that policy choice, but again, my point earlier, that has to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Even if 22 grand is the right number in the city of Portland, it makes it impossible to do affordable housing when that gets added to the land price and everything else. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that this legislature needs to look at is how do you provide a funding tool for local governments? Because mm-hmm. it costs what it costs to put water and sewer in. You can't get around it. Is it the right way to do it by house basis? That's, I think, the real issue. Mm-hmm. And the SDC waiver issue is important, again, if you don't mind one more bit of indulgence, under state law. And they cannot waive that. They have to pay it back to their SDC fund. So if Portland has resources to do this, and I applaud them for it, if they take that $22,000 off, that $22,000 out of those various funds have to come back in someplace else. Most jurisdictions don't have the financial depth or capability to do that. So SDC waivers get talked about in this process a lot. It's not a free good. It transfers money to a city that may or may not, or a county or a district that may or may not have the ability to do anything with them.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I've been very quiet and patient. Okay. I appreciate that because small towns like Sutherland, Oakland, that I represent, they simply, if they taxed everybody in their jurisdiction, they simply can't afford these multi-million-dollar EPA requirements that they're having to do to incentivize or to upgrade to potential population explosions in their town, which probably aren't going to happen. And so they simply can't afford to do that. The people in those towns can't be the burden, or the individual per unit cannot be the burden. Maybe you can try and make it work in Portland, but you can't make that work for affordable housing where we really need it in some of our rural communities. So I really think that we need to rethink how those types of infrastructures are paid for rather than paying for by the individual housing people that are either having that built on their private property or something, because it's not working. It hasn't been working. It's not going to work in the future. So I encourage you to rethink that process.
And so, I am accepting all ideas over the next couple of months and beyond, whatever we can do quickly in 2016, and then this is a long-term conversation. We are lucky that this committee is charged with housing, which has not happened before. I know you've had this conversation for 30 years, some of you, but we do have a renewed commitment to this. We're not going to solve it all, but again, you know, cities have different abilities to do waive SDCs or not, or charge demolition tax, or do a whole variety of things. The focus for us here needs to be what we as a state can do to be in partnership with our local communities. Because you can deploy or not deploy certain tools, but certain tools we don't even allow you to use, those are the things that we really need to focus on. So thank you so much. We have not been able to get a hold of John Russell, so we actually made up for a little bit of time, which is why I let Representative Hayden have that last word there.
Thank you.
But we have our last panel is Janet Bird, Oregon Housing Alliance.
I mean, you can index it and say that.
Who is going to take a look at our agenda for 2016? Some ideas. You are. And we are wrapping up this panel by 4, so thank you for.
Yes. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships and the convener of the Housing Alliance. The Housing Alliance is a statewide coalition of organizations concerned about the lack of safe, decent, and affordable housing for Oregonians. And we're mostly concerned with the stability and the access to opportunity that affordable housing brings. I want to echo folks who have said thank you to you for your diligence and your attention today and your attention to this important issue. My role is to talk about actions that the legislature could take in 2016 that would have an immediate impact on the kinds of needs that you've heard about, resources that would help folks like Jessica, would help clients served by ERCO, and as well as setting us on a good path forward to having adequate housing. There was a small article buried in the Oregonian the other day that caught my attention that hasn't gotten a lot of play. It said that 18% of Oregonians moved in a single year. That's 1 in 5 Oregonians. And I think that's evidence, you know, there are lots of reasons, and that's Oregonians moving in Oregon. Lots of evidence, I think, that our markets are in turmoil. And what that means for our educational system, what it means for our community resilience is really important to think about and reflect on. I guess the other thing I would like to say is that I think there are some people that are taking advantage of the market, and there are some bad actors out there. And as we think about how we move forward with our partners who are acting constructively and, you know, responsible business people in our communities, we also need to acknowledge that the legislature has an obligation to control some of that speculation, some of that rampant greed that's in the marketplace. So I think I would ask that you think about really bold and decisive action in 2016. There's been talk today as well about some of the preemptions and some of the policy tools that local governments are excluded from, precluded from. I think we need to think about, you know, is it time to look again at those preemptions, to take up those conversations again? I think that there's also a real need to think about how we protect tenants in the interim. We're in a crisis situation. It's time to think about, you know, a one-year pause, as Justin Borey talked about, on evictions for no cause, evictions with no stated reason, and on excessive rent increases. And, you know, there's obviously conversation that we could have about what's excessive and where that applies, but there needs to be something done to sort of tamp the heat in the marketplace. And I would call on you to think about doing something that would get us well into the 2017 legislative session so that there's time to really think about what that comprehensive package looks like. We look forward to being at the table with all of the folks that have said today that they're interested in being part of that conversation. You've also heard a lot today about resources and the need to adequately fund the tools that we have in place. And I want to emphasize what folks have said today. We have tools in place. We have systems in place that work. They are absolutely under-resourced. The resource that is used to help people like Ms. Bennington, who testified so compellingly, Emergency Housing Account and State Homeless Assistance Program, the Housing Alliance had asked for $20 million in EHA and SHAP. We need $8 million to get us to that level. That would help us put 15 more Oregonians a day into housing for the rest of the biennium. I hope I have that number right. Ryan will correct me. Yes. Okay. We also want to invest in new housing development. We created the LIFT Housing Development Fund. I'm really almost finished. The LIFT Housing Development Fund, we put $40 million into that bond program. We would like to see that additional $60 million that was in the governor's budget that we talked about through most of the legislative session to get that to $100 million. We also really need to pay attention to not increasing homelessness and to not allowing more displacement to happen where we can prevent that. We've had a great program in place since 2007 to preserve existing federally subsidized housing and manufactured home parks. It's a great public-private partnership. We had asked for $20 million in lottery-backed bonds during the 2015 session. We were allocated $2.5 million. We'd really love to see that additional $17.5 million. There's a pipeline in place. Again, as Martha McLennan and other folks talked about, we know how to spend that money well and effectively to make a difference today. And we also need to continue to prevent additional foreclosures by fully funding the foreclosure counseling program that was set up as part of the mediation program. And we estimate that we need about $3 million in general fund to finish out the biennium. Thanks again for your attention. Really appreciate, again, the energy, the dedication, and the commitment that you all show to this issue, and look forward to working with you in 2016 and into the future. Thank you.
Janet, can you just explain again what are the kinds of members that you have? It's throughout the state, and so they wear different hats. What's the compilation of?
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. The Housing Alliance is nonprofit developers. It's the housing authorities. It's the community action agencies. It's individual service providers, the Oregon Food Bank, other partners who really are both on the providing housing end as well as the helping folks into housing. We also have a number of local governments and counties that are part of the coalition. We've been around since 2004.
Great. Thank you. Yep, Representative Peluso.
Janet, this is, I hope, is a very simple question, but it's something I am having a hard time grasping. It's the 90-day no-clause eviction. Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of that, or why are people suggesting that?
So tenants who are renting an apartment are subject, kind of depending on lease terms, et cetera. Many tenants have no protection from being just told within 30 days now is the condition in most of the state, 30 days that they have to move. And they're not required to be given a reason that their tenancy is not being renewed. I mean, just imagine trying to move a family, a household, with 30 days notice, trying to accumulate first and last month's rent, the deposit, the moving expenses, figuring out how you're going to get back and forth to work, how you're going to get your kids into a new school district. I mean, so what Portland did was say we need at least 90 days if for an end of a tenancy for no cause. what we're saying is that that's maybe not long enough, you know, pretty clearly not long enough. If you're facing a situation, City of Bend, there might be 18 units for rent at any moment in time, and not a one of those affordable, you know, what are folks really supposed to do on that short timeline? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so at this time, it's Portland's idea, Portland, because I don't, to me, it was just, it's causing more homelessness. If they can't afford now and they have 90 days maybe of free rent or something, is still they're going to be homeless.
Right. So the presumption is they are liable for the rent during the additional 90 days. It's just an additional period of notice before they would have to move. And I think what we're saying is that people, even whether it's 30 days or 60 days,
right,
or 90 days,
no,
if there's nowhere to move and you can't afford to move anywhere, then yes, you're creating homelessness by giving people that kind of notice.
And that's my concern. So
yes,
thanks.
Thank
I just
you.
Wasn't
Sorry.
Sure where we
Sorry,
were.
Sorry, I went a little circular.
No, no.
Thank you.
So we are coming up on a couple of minutes to 4. I want to give this, and I see Senator Gelser there waiting very patiently. We're going to start the next one at 4, which is the child welfare. I would love to take a couple of minutes break because I think this committee has been sitting through some very intense testimony for 2 hours. So stretch your legs and then come back in a couple minutes. I do want to say that the 3 committee bills that we are introducing in this committee that you will be voting on, one will be the bonding bill for that LIFT program, which is the low-income families, new housing for low-income families that went through our committee, and we actually were in favor of $100 million for it. It ended up getting cut back for $40 million. That's the one that Janet is saying they would love, the Affordable Housing Alliance would love to see that go back up to $100. But we do, for the purpose of issuing the bonds, are going to need to pass a bill specifically that lays out some parameters in that. So that is one of our 3 bills. Another one is we're bringing back the general assistance bill, which was one that dealt with homeless adults, I think most of them vets, and that was a bill that we had, I think it was $2 million for it, so we're also aware that that population continues to really struggle. That money is reimbursed when they're applying for SSI or SSDI, and they're waiting for the average 2 years for the feds to come back. And in the meantime, if we can provide support that helps them with housing services, case management to actually apply, that's another one we want to bring back. There was some concern about money going to a study, and I think that wasn't received as well. I think most people realized that program was very effective when it was in place, and we don't need the study. We need the money to actually go to services. So you will be seeing that one again. And the third one is what we're kind of saying, housing omnibus bill. I don't know how big it'll be. We have 2 months to shape it. We're going to submit something by November 24th because we want to make the Legislative Council deadline. But I am working very closely with the Affordable Housing Alliance. And anyone that would like to present ideas, please let me know very specifically. We are going to try to get as many things in there that we can in terms of both what is the short-term relief, because we cannot wait for a bold agenda in 2017. We need to act. This is a crisis. It's become even more of a crisis than it was when we were in session in 2015. So we want to figure out what we can do to really help people who are struggling right now, but we also can't lose our eye on the ball of continuing to create supply, because we don't want to be in the same place a year from now. So what that balance is and what we can feasibly do in a short session is a really tall order, but it's one that we need to take on. So thank you so much. Let's pause for just 1 minute. I'm going to... Okay. Okay, I'm reconvening the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and we are now doing an informational meeting on Oregon's foster child system. Thank you, Senator Gelser, for kicking us off.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelster. I'm the state senator from Corvallis and Albany and Philomath and the surrounding areas. I am here to talk about what has been happening in the Senate Human Services Committee and a couple of pretty big bills that are coming out as committee bills related to children in residential care. We've all been recently made aware of revelations that children in our state custody were allowed to languish in state care while a provider allegedly misdirected nearly $2 million in public funds. The conditions under which these children were living were shocking and unacceptable. Efforts must continue to determine exactly why this organization was allowed to operate for so long and to determine whether there are similar organizations providing such substandard care to kids. That is going to take time, and frankly, that is the responsibility of the executive branch, and I'm incredibly grateful to Governor Brown for taking steps to address this so thoroughly. I have great confidence in Clyde Psyche, who has stepped in as the interim director for the Department of Human Services, and I believe that you heard the announcement yesterday that the governor and Director Psyche are putting together an outside review of children's foster care and children's residential services, and I think that is a great thing. In the meantime, legislation in 2016 is needed to ensure that the Oregon Department of Human Services has both the mandate from the legislature and the tools that are needed to protect the state's most vulnerable kids. The attached memo, which is not attached because it was attached to the email that this letter was written in, addresses an omnibus policy bill that will make residential care safe for kids. What it doesn't address is the second bill that reflects the need to appropriately resource the oversight for these organizations. One of the surprising things that I recently learned is that we have only three licensors for 203 licensed children's programs. Some of those programs have multiple sites. Three licensors for 203 licensed children's programs. If it is our expectation that that licensing department act in a way that is timely to address the shortage of placements, that that organization adequately oversee these important providers, and that they provide unannounced visits at irregular intervals during the course of the year at 203 organizations, some of which have more than one site, if you do the math, you will know that it takes more than three people. So the bill would expand the position authority for licensing, and it would also direct the department and stakeholders to work together to come back to us with recommendations for 2017 for an appropriate licensing fee structure for kids' residential services. There's currently no application fee when you apply for a license to be a children's provider, and that's somewhat unusual within licensing. But as we all know, fee schedules are difficult and complicated, and there's a lot of hydraulics. Too soon to do that in 16, but we need to set the stage to have that conversation moving forward. And I think it also needs to be said that while we're going to talk about some specific things that didn't go well here, as a legislature, we have a moral obligation to provide the appropriate resources to provide for the most vulnerable kids in the state. If we are not able to appropriately resource and step up to provide for the technology, training, central office staff, front office workers, foster care, recruitment, abuse investigators, and licensors, as a legislature, it's a little unfair to be outraged whenever we hear about things going bad if we have created a system that pretty much guarantees those kinds of outcomes for us. That said, I want to be clear. There is absolutely no excuse for what happened to the children at Give Us This Day. No child, no matter how challenging their needs, deserves to be hungry, abused, neglected, or forgotten. We must be relentless in ensuring that this never happens again. But out of this situation, we've been able to better understand some of the issues that we have in the structure of our agency, and I'd like to talk to you about those now because we can address them through legislation in February. They come in three primary areas, and this document is in OLIS. You'll be happy to know in my committee this document was 5 pages long, and it's now down to 3. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But the three areas are licensing and oversight, abuse and neglect investigations and licensed care, and leadership accountability. The first is clarifying that all foster care homes need to be certified by the state. Right now, a children's care provider, there is no oversight from the state necessarily in offering that license. We're one of the few states that does it that way. This will ensure that every child that we're placing in a home is going into a home that meets the minimum standards that we've outlined in statute and rule. We also need to clarify through this legislation when DHS has the authority to deny, revoke, suspend, or place conditions upon a license. And these would include areas where the fiscal instability of an organization threatens the safety or stability of the kids, when an organization has become subject to garnishments or bankruptcy, if there are findings with another state or federal agency of financial financial, civil, or criminal misconduct, or when an organization consistently fails to correct deficiency, denies access to kids, or there's reason to believe that kids are at immediate risk. We need to make sure that licensing can't waive statutory compliance. Right now, there's some confusion or uncertainty around what constitutes substantial compliance with licensing rules at the time of renewal, and that makes it very difficult for the department to deny a license. We have no shortage of rules and regulations. There are hundreds of them for these providers. So the argument could be made that if you are compliant in 700 of the rules and non-compliant in 800, you're substantially compliant, even if the rules you're not compliant in are you've lost kids, you don't know where they are. So this bill would say that no organization may be considered substantially compliant with licensing standards if it has deficiencies that are related to children and family rights, child abuse reporting, behavior management, resident furnishings and personal items, food services, safety, medication, or minimum staffing requirements. The bill would clarify that payments to providers must be made by electronic funds transfer rather than through a paper check. I think we've seen why that was problematic. Each site needs to have those unannounced visits over the course of their license. Licensees need to be informed annually that their child abuse reporting obligation is individual and that an organization may not say you can't report to DHS, you only report to us. They're actually required by law to report to DHS. We need to provide them the number. That was a problem in this case. As it relates to abuse and neglect investigations in licensed care, there are a number of problems that popped up. One is that all abuse investigations for kids in licensed care are based on the same standard that we apply when we initially go out and do an abusive investigation in a family home, which is based on a minimally adequate standard. When we have removed a child from a family home and taken them into state care, we necessarily should have a higher standard than minimally adequate. And we should have a standard that aligns with the contract and licensing requirements. So the proposal is to create a new definition in the abuse section that talks about a child in care. And it would simply apply the same definition that OWAPI, which is the kind of the investigation arm, uses when they investigate every other licensed facility, including licensed facilities that include children. Really important to point out, this puts no new regulations on providers. It doesn't make any new behavior that you can do today something that you can do. It just more carefully aligns those standards. It also will encompass youth age 18 to 20 that are committed to the care of the state. Right now, the department has no authority to investigate abuse for youth of that age that we are caring for. The other thing that we believe this will help us do is to make substantiated abuse reports that are redacted to protect the confidentiality of victims part of the public record in the same way they are for other licensed facilities. This is really important for us to understand the safety of our system and what some of the issues are, and frankly, to understand why it is important to change the abuse standard. It's very hard to look at that, and I can just tell you that just because you look at a provider that has a whole series of unsubstantiated allegations of abuse, that can give us a very false sense of the well-being of the children in that case if you were to look at what those issues are. We want to make sure when there's a substantiated allegation, there's appropriate notification to the CASAs, the attorneys, and the caseworkers of all the children living in that facility so that they continue to have eyes on. And that when it...
Can you take like two more minutes?
Yeah.
We're running a little behind.
Getting close. When a child is alleged to be a victim, then their CASA and their attorney need to know about that, and their caseworker. And that's been a problem in this case as well. And then whenever someone notices a crime occurring in a licensed care facility, that needs to immediately be reported to law enforcement. We need to make it clear in statute that OWAPI has access to everyone that they need to interview, and that the organization cannot say you cannot interview a witness or a child outside the presence of somebody that works in that organization, and that a child that has an attorney is able to access their attorney to be part of that. The last piece is the leadership accountability. When there's an organization like the Department of Justice, the Department of Revenue, or BOLI that is making findings about an organization, they need to immediately report that to DHS, and we're talking about organizations that are providing care to vulnerable populations. DHS has to be willing to receive that information. When they receive that information, they have to, the director of DHS must allow that information to be shared with the appropriate agency personnel so that they can make appropriate decisions moving forward. And the failure to do that would be considered criminal level official misconduct. That is the nut of it. In your OLIS, you'll have this document. I noticed there are some typos that were added in there as I tried to make it shorter. The abuse definition that I'm talking about so that you can see what it is. It's word for word what it is for kids with IDDD, adults with developmental disabilities, and seniors in foster care and licensed facilities. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we only have a short time for questions. We're going to have lots of opportunities to talk about this in the next few weeks. Representative Taylor.
I just want to make sure I have the opportunity for all of us to thank Senator Gelser for her amazing work on this. It's really been incredible, and I'm just so proud of you for doing this. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Ni hao.
Thank you.
Representative
Taylor. Yeah, I agree with that. You've put your heart and soul into this important issue. It's so disturbing to read the reports in the newspapers all too frequently. I want to question the assumption that maybe we have just misallocated use of resources in DHS because the budget's gone up considerably the past few bienniums. And on top of that, isn't it true that Give Us This Day was on the radar list in the agency for months, even years, and nothing was done? It wasn't a lack of people investigating. It was a lack of people following through when there was already identified problems.
Chair Kinnegeyer, Representative Bueller, I'm glad you answered that question. First, I do not believe that what happened at Give Us This Day is a result of financial resources. What happened there is absolutely inexcusable. However, I also believe that licensing has, when you're on that radar list, the tools are not necessarily there to be able to revoke a license. For example, in our hearing the other day, there is another provider right now that is licensed by the Department of Human Services that has been on that radar list longer, and the department has been unsuccessful at revoking that license. My understanding is that these statutory changes would allow them to act more rapidly in a case like that and actually give them the tools. Today, if they know that there is a risk to health and safety, they don't necessarily have the authority to restrict admissions or revoke that license, and that's a problem.
Okay, just a quick follow-up.
Yep,
then how come they were shut down almost immediately after the Willamette Week article?
Representative Kinnegeyer, Representative Bueller, they went into receivership through an action of the Department of Justice. The reason that Give Us This Day is shut down today is not because of any findings of DHS. It's because they violated the laws around charitable activities.
We are going to be hearing a lot more about this. I want to just echo all the thanks for Senator Gelser for really digging into this. We've been divide and conquer, and we're focused a little more on the housing issue, although the child welfare is very important. We've tried to keep that on the front burner constantly in the last year, but she has really, really dug in to look in hundreds and hundreds of pages, I think, that you've looked at, to look at what actually can be done. And again, 2016 is not a session that we usually do big, bold things, but these are kinds of things that just can't wait. So I really appreciate that. We're going to be looking very carefully at your legislation after it passes out of the Senate and comes, it'll be coming over to us. So the more you can kind of get background on it, ask, so you have offered to meet with anyone. Talk to anyone on the phone about it. So
call me,
make sure.
Anybody that's listening, call me. And it will have an emergency clause. And when I come next time, I'll tell you why I think it actually deserves one.
Okay, great.
We do have an emergency.
Okay.
Thank you
so much. Okay, Lois Day from DHS.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegeyer. For the record, my name's Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human Services. I also want to thank Senator Gelser and have thanked her in her committee for her advocacy on behalf of the children in foster care in Oregon. I think that what she's doing is going to cause improvements in our system, and we're looking forward to working with her to make sure that the needed changes get in place. I can imagine you have questions for me, given what she has said and what has come out, and I'm also cognizant of the what the agenda is today. And so what I have spoken with the chair about is that I, of course, am staying for the duration of this hearing, and if there's time for questions at the end, I will stay to answer those. And if not, I will meet with each one of you individually and respond to your questions as quickly as I can get that scheduled, if that's your desire. I want to be available to you to, as we work through this, to make sure you have the information you need to make the decisions you're going to be asked to make. One of the things I'd like to add to what Senator Gelser said was related to the governor's external evaluation of the department's activities in the, with this provider. There's also three internal audits underway right now, one of the investigations, one of the licensing, and one of the intersection of contracts and work in the field. In addition, I heard from the governor yesterday in her testimony that she's putting together a, I think, an advisory group to be a sounding board for the external reviewer that they're bringing in, and she anticipates she'll have the membership of that sounding board group set by the end of this week. So things will be moving quickly, which is a good thing. I believe you've received three handouts from me, and I'll also provide them electronically. Two of those handouts have information about our foster care system, and I would reference you to the PowerPoint that we did in front of this committee during the last session that really outlines the department's actions around recruitment, licensing or certification, training, placements, monitoring, and support of foster homes. In Oregon, we currently have just over 4,000 certified family foster homes to take care of children who come into placement. While that may appear to be adequate with about 7,800 children in care, it's not. Best practices require that when a child comes into care, there's sufficient homes with a wide variety of skills available so a match can occur that best meets the needs, the unique needs of that child coming into care. One of the programs you're going to hear from as soon as I get off this table is from Embrace Oregon, and they will describe for you how they're coming alongside the department to increase the number and support for families available for fostering. You also have a document describing the department's Title IV-E waiver demonstration project. We have a waiver of our Title IV-E, so for every child who does not come into care, we can keep those federal dollars here to match the general fund and increase the service array. With this particular demonstration project, which we're required to have one when you get that waiver, we're attempting to prevent long stays for children in care. That project, we've used predictive analytics to identify characteristics of families and their children when the children first come into care that are most likely to remain in care for 2 years or longer. And we have we hope to prevent these long stays by applying a trio of services early on when children and families with those identified characteristics enter our system now. So we'll apply those services at 60 days in hopes that it will facilitate a quicker return. Those services are intensive family finding, structured and frequent family meetings, and peer parent mentors. You'll also hear a presentation this afternoon from the Permanency Coalition, which is a group of private providers in Oregon that have come together to identify innovative ways of delivering services in an effort to move children to more quickly to permanency and prevent the long stay in foster care as well. And we have been working with the coalition, and we look forward to our continuing work with them to deliver those services and reduce the length of stay. And that is all I have, because there's people with more exciting things to tell you than I.
So that's great, and I know you're willing to stay to the end, and I do want to make sure that we have time for the people who have come down who don't normally speak to us. So that's great. I'm going to hold off on any specific questions for Lois. I want to reiterate that she is willing to talk to anybody anytime, and Clyde, who is now in his sixth day of the new interim position, rather than continually parade two people who are interim directors of DHS before you, because he is interim, we thought it would be better to make use of the time of people who are in the community trying to meet the needs. So part of what we're trying to get at, and where Senator Gelser is going, is, you know, where we have run into trouble and things have not worked well in the system that we currently have, and that's a very important look. But the other piece of the equation is, how do we, you know, we get in the situation because kids get left in bad placements because we don't have enough families. And so how do we move forward with that so we can really expand? You talked about, you know, it might look like you have 100 kids and 100 placements. It looks like 100%, but it's not, because not every if you have a one-to-one like that, not every family is going to be appropriate. So it's really important that we expand that. Representative Evans. Can the Embrace please come up while he's asking a question.
Thank you, Chair. I don't have a question, but I do have a statement. I'm relatively new to the world of DHS, and when I first got on the committee, I was nervous about an agency that was as big as it is, because I look at the Pentagon as a big bureaucracy that isn't always good because it's all together. And I want to applaud Senator Gelser and everybody that's been involved in trying to figure out the specific fixes. I don't think it's good to throw the baby out with the bathwater, literally or figuratively. That said, if there's not a sharper, clearer accountability, and when I hear leadership accountability, not just of those that are providing services, but the folks in the management chain.
Yep.
The Navy has a good tradition. Whether it's your fault or not, when the ship hits the ground, you're done.
Right.
And to restore Oregon's trust in this agency, we need to have very aggressive accountability.
Right.
So I just want that part of the discussion.
So I appreciate that, and I think that is where the governor's coming from with an independent investigation, and on top of the three audits that's happening. I will say, in terms of this advisory group that she's putting together, we'll name by the end of the week, there will be engagement by this committee on that, and so we look forward to staying very closely tied to that. And at the same time, it's like the rental housing situation and the long-term supply. We need to continue working on how are we increasing the number of families and the training and support, as you have so eloquently brought up. You know, what are we doing to move ahead with the challenges? And so that's the other part of the equation. So on that, please introduce yourselves.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Kenny Geyer, and the committee. Thanks for the invitation to join today. My name is Ben Sand, and I am a foster parent with DHS here in Oregon, as well as I serve as the CEO for the Portland Leadership Foundation.
My name is Jelana Goebel. I'm also a foster parent with DHS Child Welfare, and I am the founder of Embrace Oregon.
And I'm Brooke Gray, also a foster parent with DHS Child Welfare and the director of Embrace Oregon.
Thank you.
It's an honor to be here today with our colleagues from DHS and with you all as we consider how we can together improve outcomes for children and for families in our state's foster care system. We're aware that now is an inflection point considering the state's child welfare system, and we have spent years now thinking about how we can improve outcomes for kids in care. We're not a service provider, and in our thinking, we believe we've identified what we're calling a third way, where the community's role in partnering with DHS increases to serve children and families. Portland Leadership Foundation launched Embrace Oregon and the new statewide Every Child campaign because we believe that with the right posture, Oregonians and individuals and families can and will step forward to meet the needs of children in Oregon's foster care system. I'm a city kid. I've grown up in the city. I come from a single-parent family. I grew up struggling with the threats that come with poverty. After going to college, I committed to doing whatever I could to serve the city of Portland with a particular focus on serving underrepresented communities. Our work at Portland Leadership Foundation is expansive. We have a portfolio of initiatives, from scholarship initiatives to mentoring programs with student athletes to a fellows initiative. And we're focused on multicultural leadership development, but we also are involved with government partnerships in the Portland metropolitan area. I'm not an expert in all things, but I love my city. We're aggressive, and at PLF, we give everything we have to serve vulnerable children and families. But 4 years ago, really to my own embarrassment, I was mostly ignorant to the work of DHS. Like most Oregonians, I was aware of the negative narrative of the agency that comes forth through the media and is on the streets. I knew the basics, and I knew most people wanted to stay away from the agency. And then one day, that bubble broke for me. Portland Leadership Foundation is an idea incubator. We encourage the development of ideas, and when people want to serve Portland's most vulnerable families, we welcome them and take regular meetings with community members who have dreams of serving. And 4 years ago, my friend Jelana walked into our office with one of these, which is what's called a welcome box. If you're like me, I was curious, what is in that box when she walked into our office? And so I'm going to let Jelana tell the story.
As a foster parent, I asked my certifier a few years ago, what are children doing when they're in this especially vulnerable time of waiting after they've been removed from their home and they're waiting in a DHS child welfare office? And she just painted this picture of scrambling each and every time. And so with the support of those from my faith community, came up with the idea of welcome boxes, which is simply age-appropriate boxes given to children of brand new items, which they can keep in this vulnerable time of waiting. The community's response to making these boxes took off in a way that nobody could have anticipated. And these boxes have become a humble catalyst of the community beginning to ask larger questions. First, why are children waiting in the office in the first place? And secondly, are there other places in which my family, my faith community, my Girl Scout troop, my business, my school can get involved? And the community momentum just took off from there.
After meeting with Jelana, it really caught my attention. Initially, I thought, well, building boxes for kids in that moment is probably not a big enough initiative for us to throw our foundation's weight behind. But really what caught my attention was maybe at the acorn of the question, and that is, what is happening at the local DHS office? And as we moved forward, we committed to two things. Number one, we began researching the agency, what it does, who works there, and where it's located throughout the city. We found that most Oregonians don't know where DHS is located. We found that most Oregonians actually don't know what happens at DHS. And so we gathered different groups of leaders together, different folks from faith communities in our city, and we began a conversation rooted in this question, what if we stepped forward and did something to build a relationship with DHS? In Portland's Tri-County area in the last year, 3,694 kids spent time in foster care, and 70.3% lived in more than one foster home. We learned that there is a crisis shortage of foster homes, and as a result, nearly each week, siblings are separated when they enter foster care. It means that during a child's moment of greatest vulnerability, they are removed temporarily from their birth parents and at times bounce from one short-term home to another because of the shortage of homes. And it means that our community's children are suffering as a result.
I wanted to share with you a short story. Last year, on the Friday before Thanksgiving, I picked up the phone and heard Emily, my DHS certifier. Emily works hard and speaks gently and professionally. "We really need help," Emily told me, and proceeded to share with me about a toddler that had been waiting in the Gresham DHS office for countless hours that I'll refer to as Grace. I listened over the phone about this three-year-old who had never had a bed or any sort of sleeping schedule and was totally nonverbal and who needed a safe home for the weekend. We said yes. When Grace was dropped off, her body language and dark eyes screamed, "I've experienced trauma." On Monday afternoon, Emily called to share that requests were put out to Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, and no families were available to take her. She said quite simply, "There is a crisis shortage of homes." It struck me in this moment that DHS Child Welfare cannot wave a magic wand and make families suddenly appear for Grace, and that the agency, despite desiring to do their very best by vulnerable children, is only as strong as the foster families who choose to engage with them. "Could we keep her for just a few more days?" I was asked. Grace was around my table for Thanksgiving last year, and we were privileged to have her. Grace needed a safe and loving home, and we had that to offer, but only for the short term. On day 7 in our home, Grace accompanied me to a child's birthday party, quite possibly the first she'd ever attended. The theme? Superheroes. As Grace delightfully decorated her mask with gobs of glitter, glue, and sparkles, I thought about how this precious girl doesn't need somebody who changes into tights, dons a cape, and has a secret identity. What Grace needs is a foster family who finds her worthy of loving attention and will commit to her long well-being. Emily called me Friday afternoon to say that despite searching all of that week, no home could be found. My family's routine of work and school schedule will be resuming on Monday, and DHS would be sending a caseworker to come pick her up to wait back in the office while they continue to search for a family. There was no way around it. How do you tell a three-year-old girl that there are no certified foster families available in three counties to welcome her because they are all at capacity? And it's not time to place blame or point fingers, because foster families for vulnerable children come from the community. And while foster care is certainly not for everyone, it has to be for more than are currently engaging with it. And as much as I want to reassuringly whisper to Grace and say, "It's okay, sweet girl," while buckling her up in her car seat in that government vehicle, I don't, because it is not. And Grace went back to wait in that same DHS child welfare office that she had been waiting in 9 days prior, not for a superhero, but simply for a certified foster family. Grace waited in the office for 10 hours. Thankfully, she was there with two Embrace Oregon office moms, an unprecedented initiative of ours that pairs caring, fingerprinted volunteers to wait with children in this time of waiting at a DHS child welfare office, but still, 10 hours. A foster family came and picked her up at 6 p.m. For our partners working in DHS child welfare and as foster families, we see children like Grace and the need for more loving, certified homes every single day.
We hear this story regularly, and for us it's unacceptable. And so Portland Leadership Foundation decided to start a pilot where we would begin encouraging the community to come alongside the agency with no quid pro quo, but just to serve. We asked DHS leadership for partnership. We asked DHS if we could invite community members into a more robust relationship with the agency. And we decided that we were going to love the people that work at DHS and to do whatever we could to come alongside the children and families that they serve. We had four original faith communities step forward, and four turned into 17, and 17 turned into 37. And in January of 2013, I was at a soccer practice for my three-year-old daughter, soccer tots or whatever it's called. And I received a voicemail, and when I got into my car, I listened to the voicemail, and it sounded like this. It said, "Hey, Ben, this is Steve Dean from the Oregonian, and I've been talking with folks at DHS, and they say that what you're doing is the beginning of a revolution. I'm going to write an article in the Sunday Oregonian. You probably want to call me back." I remember calling him back and thinking, this is uncanny. We don't even have a website. We have no budget. All we're doing is encouraging Portlanders to get involved with DHS. And sure enough, 24 hours later, on the front page of the Oregonian, the title was, "A Revolution in Portland's Foster Care." The title was hyperbolic in nature, and there was certainly not necessarily a revolution taking place. But from that moment on, the stream of interest turned into a river, and the river turned into a flood.
Today, there are over 100 different faith communities working in partnership with DHS in the Tri-County area. We have seen dozens of businesses step forward, from insurance companies to law firms to Girl Scout troops to auto body shops. This is truly a citywide effort. Embrace Oregon has completed 12 makeovers of DHS offices so that they communicate dignity, worth, and value to our most vulnerable children and families. And altogether, over 3,000 volunteers have stepped forward. We have seen over 600 tangible needs met through the community when DHS requests it. And Embrace Oregon is offering regular hospitality to DHS staff as well as foster families. In these boxes, there have been over 12,000 made, and they're used for all sorts of purposes. Today, though, we're here to talk about foster care. And since Embrace Oregon started in May 2013, we have seen 120 certified foster families come to DHS through Embrace Oregon's efforts, with another 40 currently in process. While we are proud of these numbers, we aren't satisfied with the progress, and Brooke will share more about our strategy moving forward.
If you can keep it really tight, because we're way over.
Totally.
It's a very compelling story, but we are over time.
So in May of this year, we launched a new initiative called Every Child. We are setting out to change the way that Oregonians think about foster care. And this new Every Child effort reflects the deep hope that we have in partnership with DHS to ensure that every child would have a safe, healthy home to flourish. This effort is a two-pronged strategy. First, we will change the way Oregonians think about foster care by breaking down the stigma associated with the word foster and reflecting stories of foster families who are stepping forward for all the right reasons and of children who are thriving despite childhood trauma and more.
Second, we will engage communities around the state of Oregon, encouraging them to step forward in partnership with DHS. Since launching this initiative in May, we have had an unprecedented number of inquiries to become foster families. In fact, 3.87 inquiries are coming through our organization each week. We know that Oregon is facing incredible challenges, and we know that we can do better. Our conviction is that DHS is only as strong as the community that comes alongside it. And by creating a climate where hospitality, radical generosity, and customer service overflow, we begin to change our community from the inside out. It's not about the money. To ask a foster family to welcome foster children into their home is a massive request. And while it may sound crazy, we don't think that DHS can make that request alone. The community needs to call itself to more.
Yeah. So we don't have a lot of time, but you can probably tell why I was so compelled to bring them forward. I think, you know, the one side of the situation is the accountability that we need to stay on top of and the, you know, the legislative oversight of the executive branch. But the other is, you know, to really help figure out how we can support efforts in the community that are getting at the heart of the problem, so that we don't end up in the same place that we are. And I think you guys are doing phenomenal work. Your stories are phenomenal. Your numbers are phenomenal. You're making a huge difference. And I'm just glad to make this introduction to this committee. So
thanks for coming. I know you guys are, I know of at least one location that you're looking to replicate. Mm-hmm. Do you have multiple other locations throughout the state that you are currently in the process of attempting to replicate?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Stark. We are partnering with DHS in this Every Child effort to replicate our efforts, and our initial target communities are going to be Lane County, Josephine County, and Jackson County. And so we've given ourselves a two-year window to see if we can see the Portland Leadership Foundation of Grants Pass step forward. So we have some ideas. There's somebody in Grants Pass, actually, that might have, you know, some help to provide.
Thank you so much. I wish we had more time, but we want to make sure we get to the next panel. Thank you so much for all your work. And I do want to say Jelana is my constituent. So
we all
three of you are. See? What a great district I have. Thank you so much. Okay, so the next panel is Mark McKechnie, I'm sorry, Jim Seymour, and I think Janet is not able to come because of the plane, so Robin Donnert, or Donert. Mark, would you like to start?
I would. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice and currently chair of a group called the Oregon Permanency Coalition. The coalition is comprised of nonprofit and non-governmental organizations that serve and advocate for Oregon's foster children. And just briefly to give you the membership of the organizations involved, Boys and Girls Aid, Bridge Meadows, Catholic Community Services, CASA of Multnomah, Washington, and Columbia Counties, Children First for Oregon, Kinship House, New Avenues for Youth, Youth Rights and Justice, and Youth Villages. And we began meeting a few years ago out of our shared concern that too many children are stuck in Oregon's foster care system, meaning that they don't achieve permanency in a timely manner or, in some cases, at all. And hopefully you know what I'm referring to when I talk about permanency, just to make sure we all know what we're referring to. That sort of the top three are: the child returns home to one or both parents, the child is adopted, or goes into a permanent guardianship. And there are some others that are more complicated, but those are the top three in terms of preference. We appreciate this opportunity to talk to you for the first time as a coalition, and hope this is the start of a conversation. We're not coming to you right now with specific policy recommendations, but we want to engage with you in this conversation. And just so you understand the group of children that we're talking about. We requested data from DHS a year ago now, based on the group that we knew was there and that many of us serve and many of us worry about, many of us lose sleep over, and that's children who are long stayers in foster care, and we define them as in foster care more than 3 years. And the data we got back from DHS was that there are 1,946 children on that date when they pulled the data who had been in foster care for 3 years or longer. And that's roughly a quarter of the average daily population of children in foster care. There were some disturbing aspects to the data that we saw. One is that the median number of placements that each of those children had experienced was greater than four. So more than half of the children in that group had been in five or more placements, and the top end in that range was 49 separate placements. But conversely, more than half had been in their current placement for less than a year. So by both of those measures, you're seeing instability. You're seeing lots of placement moves and also a lack of stability in their current placement for more than half of that group. And I provided two charts that are in OLIS to help represent some of this data that you can refer to. Only 19% of them are placed with relatives. That's lower than the average for our foster care population are placed with relatives. And there were less than 10% that are essentially moving in a meaningful way to clear permanency outcomes. They're either in a pre-adoptive placement or in a trial home visit with one or both parents. So less than 10% of that over 1,900 children. And there have been other initiatives, there have been many initiatives in the foster care world over years, and some of the most recent ones have targeted preventing foster care entry on the front end, and also helping move the children that are just this close, they're almost to permanency, but there's some barrier that needs to be addressed and overcome so that they can achieve permanency. Those initiatives are valuable, but they haven't necessarily addressed the needs of this population, and that was part of the reason why this coalition formed, was to bring attention to this group. As I said, we're still in the process of discussing what might become concrete policy or other proposals, but we've certainly identified some of the barriers, and one of the biggest ones that I think we have consensus on among all the various members of the coalition is that there is a lack of flexibility in funding that pays for placements and pays for services. And there is a conflict in terms of the placements that provide greater amounts of support for kids who are struggling are by definition and by design not permanent. They're short-term placements. So that's part of the reason why we see this population bouncing around to multiple placements, is when they get the support they need to stabilize, they have to move because the placement is designed to be short term, and then they may get worse again and end up back in a more intensive level of support. That conflict has to be resolved to help this population. So children have been stuck in foster care due to these and other system barriers, and we really want to focus on this population as one that we're going to lose. They are going to be they suffer many injuries in the broad sense by spending much of their lives in foster care, and they become the people who then have very poor outcomes in adulthood as well. So we need to grapple with these issues and this population. We found that DHS shares our concern about this population, and they've been working with us in terms of providing data, and some of the provider organizations who are part of the coalition have been working directly with DHS to come up with new service models and funding approaches to try to deal with some of the systemic issues. And Jim Seymour is here from Catholic Community Services to tell you a little bit more about those efforts. Our hope is that these sort of pilot efforts will help create a roadmap for how we can achieve broader systemic changes and help get these children unstuck from the foster care system. Thank you for your attention. I'm happy to answer questions.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Jim Seymour, and I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services. We're a state-licensed and nationally accredited foster care organization, and we've been working with foster children for the last 40 years in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. But today I'm speaking to you as a member of the Permanency Coalition. Children and youth in long-term foster care need to be supported to transition out of foster care to a nurturing, permanent family of their own. We need to reduce the length of time children stay in foster care and the number of disrupted foster care placements that children experienced during their time in the system. Many of the service providers who are members of the Permanency Coalition, including Catholic Community Services, have been working for several months with Jason Walling and Lois Day at DHS to come up with service contracts that would allow us to do this very thing. The service packages that we are offering are based on a collective impact approach among members of the coalition that will allow us to achieve results none of us have been able to achieve on our own. We are encouraged by the progress we have made with DHS. They have been open to the idea of using their funding more flexibly in exchange for more accountability for results. While solutions are complex and approaches must be individualized for each child, the coalition has come to the conclusion that flexible funding coupled with more accountability for results is essential to transitioning more children out of foster care into nurturing permanent families of their own. An effort needs to be made to reduce the number of disrupted foster care placements and the length of time children spend in the foster care system. And finally, that system outcomes need to be measured over time to show if there is progress being made in the right direction. We need more foster parents who are trained and who are provided enough support to care for children with more significant emotional and behavior problems. All of the people in the foster child's life, the foster parents, the caseworkers, and the treatment providers, need to understand and know how to respond to the trauma that these children have suffered. We need to be more accountable as well to achieve better outcomes for the children in foster care who are not thriving and not moving towards permanency. More flexibility in funding coupled with clear outcome measures and accountability for all system stakeholders will be the key. We believe the progress in the foster care system should be measured over time. One way to measure success would be to have DHS report to the legislature on a regular basis on some of the most important system indicators. These would include how many and what percentage of children have been in care for more than 3 years, the number of placements these children have had, and the number and percentage of children who age out of foster care without ever finding a nurturing, permanent family of their own. Over time, these numbers should change. The system needs to continue to improve. If that does not happen, programs that don't work should lose funding, and programs that are successful should be scaled up. We very much appreciate your time and are happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So you two represent the Permanency Coalition, and Robin, you're not necessarily part of that. Is that right?
No.
Right. So are there any questions for them from the Permanency Coalition?
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. An observation. I mean, Mark, it's been a long many years since we connected your work with NASW, and I'm glad to see you're still advocating on behalf of kids. And certainly, Jim, I know your work. I just found it interesting. I mean, we had a whole session, the majority of today, dedicated to affordable housing. And it's we all know that stable housing really decreases risk factors. But I can just imagine what lack of stable home must do to people. So, again, appreciate your work and thank you for your efforts.
I have a specific question. Can you give an example of flexible funding, something that you're not allowed to do now that you would like to be able to do?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, the system right now is designed so that if children's needs aren't being met in the program they're in, mm-hmm. they have to move to another program to get those needs met. Mm. And like Mark said, once those needs are met, then they're expected to step back down. Mm-hmm. And that's system where kids, by design, are forced to move around. What these kids, the ones that have been in there for more than 3 years, all kids, I believe, need is a safe, stable, nurturing home. And so when we have a system that's designed to move them around, mm-hmm. we're undermining the basic thing that they need. So we need a system that can provide enough support to the foster parents who are caring for them so that they don't have to be moved. Mm-hmm.
So they either get more or less money according to their needs, and they might step up or step down as they progress in some way?
Right,
is that
right.
A little bit what you're getting at?
Yes. What we've been able to raise a significant amount of money in Marion County to test a program where we actually provide a stable home for the children, and we do move the level of support up and down for both the foster parent and the child to meet their needs. Mm-hmm. And through that, we've been able to show that the kids, that are able to have a permanent place. 40% of those kids have ended up finding a permanent home with a relative or being adopted just as the result of being able to put down some roots. And so that kind of flexibility is one of the things that we need.
Okay, Representative Parrish.
Real briefly, so when I hear you've got kids that have been in foster care and they're these, long-term and average placement of 3 years or whatever, where is the snag in getting them into a permanent home? Is it you're struggling with parental rights issues through the court system? Is it, there's a lack of an available relative? So last year, we got a notification from Washington State DHS that wanted to have my niece effectively. And, would we be available? And they placed, but they placed very, very quickly. So it went with a maternal relative. So is it the relatives are not willing, parental rights, it's taking too long to sever them if the parent really can't take the child back? Or is it sort of this, we're dealing with a lot of chances for a parent to, rehabilitate whatever issue before we can place, and that's taking time? I'm like, where's the snake time? Because to me, 3 years, type of a wait is too long.
Representative Parrish, Chair Kenny Geyer, I think part of the reason why we picked 3 years as sort of a cutoff or where we wanted to focus is that I think most children who come into foster care and on are well on track to adoption by the three-year mark if there's a clear pathway and some of the court processes have moved along. And while it may take more than 3 years to actually finalize the adoption because of the process you have to go through, terminating parental rights and all those kinds of things, they're still well on track towards that goal by the three-year mark in many cases. And the children we're most concerned about, I think many of them are have experienced more significant trauma and have more significant behavioral and emotional issues as a result, and in many cases the average foster parent is unprepared to deal with those things and don't have sufficient support. I think sort of also addressing the chair's question as well, I think we envision a flexible funding to basically be funding tied to the child, not to the service, and more of a wraparound approach where you look at what the child really needs and then you put it in place and you figure out a way to pay for it, rather than trying to pigeonhole children into one program or another that may or may not be a good fit for them. And I think another aspect of these conversations that are going on between the providers and DHS is that they're talking about combining their services in a way to complement one another, more of an a la carte approach where the services can be provided when it's really appropriate and meets the child's needs, but the services aren't necessarily defined by this child is served by youth villages, therefore all of the services they receive at one time have to be delivered by youth villages, or this child is served by Catholic Community Services, therefore they're receiving all of the money and therefore they have to do everything for the child at that mm-hmm. point in time. We're sometimes trying to put square pegs in round holes by having a mismatch between what the child needs and what's available at that time. And if we can keep children in a placement and bring the support to them, maybe not even, hopefully not move them out of a foster placement that's otherwise a good foster placement, but bring the support
to them, to the child, and to the foster home, and prevent the disruption, because we know that the disruptions actually just exacerbate the problems that they came in with.
So I'm going to cut it off here only because I want to make sure Robin has a chance. And again, this was 25 people in 3 hours. I really appreciate everyone sticking with this and staying focused. It's a chance to just at least make an introduction, realize that there's community groups who have some good suggestions about what we need to be doing to get on top of finding appropriate families, making sure that kids don't languish there, making sure that families have the support and the training that they need, making sure that the resources are flexible enough to follow it. I mean, there's a lot of different pieces to this solution. We're not going to solve it here. So please feel free, if you are willing to be contacted by legislators, we will share your information. So thank you. Sorry, it's like 5 o'clock. So Robin, go.
Chair Kinnegeyer, members of the committee. I'm Robin Donard. I'm the executive director of Maple Star Oregon, and I'm also a board member of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs and the chair of their foster care affinity group. The alliance represents $235 million in services provided by 44 members to over 100,000 children throughout the state of Oregon. Maple Star Oregon is a nonprofit organization. We provide services throughout the state, and we primarily have two different service lines. One is on the early intervention side, differential response, in-home safety services through child welfare, but we also have a great deal of services in therapeutic foster care, and that is not DHS regular, what they call regular foster care, but for those who are particularly high needs, difficult, challenging behaviors, emotional difficulties that need a great deal of support, supervision, and services. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to, I'll be as brief as I possibly can in these couple of minutes. I know that there were electronic versions of materials that were provided to you, so I'll just emphasize a couple of different points. One is that we are very open to the collaborative work together with DHS and other agencies in order to come to a solution to some of these issues that have been raised. We're greatly upset and aggrieved at the circumstances that bring us here, but do appreciate the attention and the passion that's being brought to this matter, since it is our passion as well.
Are you talking about specifically Give Us a Stay or broader?
Well, Give Us a Stay brought us here, is bringing this level of attention, which, while the circumstances are horrible, we appreciate the fact that we're able to focus on these issues and come to some solutions. One of the handouts that you were provided with talks about some of the supports, the concepts that we do support, and some of those are those from Senator Gelser's proposed omnibus bill, other things that we've been working on with other providers, with the alliance. Top of our priority, though, is that we want to focus currently, specific to Give Us This Day and those issues around the shelter system, and looking at whether that is an appropriate level of care. If it is an appropriate level of care, what standards are being set? What is the limit on the length of stay? What are the training requirements for staff, for foster parents? What are the guidelines around that? What are those expectations? And what is keeping children from being referred to the appropriate level of care that's getting them into those circumstances in the first place. As a result of legislation that we worked on with Representative Nathanson through House Bill 2233, we're actually already in the process of a collaborative effort with multiple agencies, provider agencies, DHS Child Welfare, OIA, the licensing folks, the people at investigations, DD services, as well as advocacy agencies, to focus on child safety. We're looking at data. We're looking at ways to collaborate together, looking for solutions, durable solutions to the issues that we've seen arise here. So that was as brief as I could keep it. I appreciate this opportunity, and I'm open to any questions, and I am willing to be contacted as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. We will make sure that everyone has your three email addresses. Any other last-minute questions? Well, this has been a great hearing. You can see that 2016 is going to be a big session. get lots of sleep between now and then. Send her your ideas. And thank you all so much for testifying. And I will bring a close to the informational hearing and bring a close to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
Who's not doing that job? Sending them all down. Who's not doing that job? Sending them all down.